Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Kicking with Keeler here on Full Press Radio, episode number 70. We don't count the Bracket Palooza episode as a episode, so to speak, but it is now officially 70 episodes, so thanks to all those who have tuned in over this journey. Hope you're all staying safe, hope you're all wearing a mask, hope you have a great holiday weekend, those who celebrate Passover, those who celebrate Easter. Hope you all enjoy that as well. We have a great show coming up for you. We have so many sports to get into this week. We got the Final Four coming up later tonight down in Indianapolis. I keep saying down, but I'm in New York. Doesn't make any sense. We got opening day in baseball. We're going to get into my takeaways, and you'll get my picks for the season. Even though it's two games in, I'm not going to change any of my picks. So you'll get the picks I gave on the Pinstripe Prospects Chasing 28 podcast earlier this week. We'll get into football, 17-game schedule. We'll talk about that. We'll do a little Masters preview. That's right, the Masters are next week. So because we don't, but next time we'll talk to you, the Masters will be currently going on. I'll give you my thoughts on Augusta National. Yeah, I'll give you a pick. Not really confident in it, but I'll give you a pick. Of course, the coaching search in basketball, the coaching carousel has been really crazy. And transfer rules and everything like that. I'm going to get into everything related to that. In this first segment, we're going to have a couple of guests on throughout the show, so much to get into. We got to jam-pack everything, but that's why you're here to listen to Kicking with Keeler, so definitely appreciate you tuning in. I want to remind you, you can follow me on Twitter, at RickNader555. It's at R-E-C-K, letter I, Nader, like a Terminator, and three fives. You can follow us on Twitter, at FP underscore coverage, at Full Press Radio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or get your podcast. Just search Kicking with Keeler. Chances are you will find the podcast. Please give us a rating. Tell us what you like. Tell us what you don't like. And email me, rickjkeeler@gmail.com. That's rickj, letter J, keeler@gmail.com. And be sure to download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. You get all of our articles, podcasts, live shows, which we'll say a little bit more about a little bit later in the show, and so much more. You're going to want to download the app. It's great. So definitely appreciate it if you do so. So let's get into college basketball. Elite Eight over the weekend. And to me, when I look at the Elite Eight matchups, I'll start in the Midwest with Houston. And we talked with Andy Giannis from the Daily Cougar last week. And to me, this was Houston's defense. I know Oregon State did a good job getting back in that ball game, cutting the lead to four. But Houston just had too much. Sasser with 20. Grimes with 18. They got a good boost from 10-8-8 from Dejan Giroux, who Andy told you about as being that impact player for the Cougars. And while Oregon State shot almost 47% as a team, there were 6 of 16 from beyond the arc. And that alone is not going to get it done in these ball games. Ethan Thompson, just 3 of 12 shooting. And a great run for Oregon State from Pac-12 conference champs in the tournament to a near Final Four. You got to tip your cap to them, but Houston was just the better team. My favorite game of the four was probably Baylor, Arkansas. It was really good, high-paced game, at least for a half. And the problem was Arkansas just couldn't hit a three in the second half. You had Moses Moody, though, with just 11 points, 2 for 10 shooting, not one of his better games. And while Arkansas had 4 players double figures and dominated Baylor on the glass, the Bears just have too much. We look at Mitchell, Jared Butler, Macy O'Teague. Their depth is right on par with Gonzaga's. They shot only 15 threes, but they hit 8 of them, shot about 48%. Baylor had a couple of scares in this game, but not enough to where they would not advance. Then on Tuesday, you get Gonzaga. Easy win over USC. I think people were surprised about how easy it was. The Bulldogs did a good job dominating on the glass. They won the rebounding margin by 12, and that's impressive considering Evan Mobley's on the other side for USC. But 23 from Drew Timmy, who's been one of the best players in this tournament. 18 from Kispert. Jalen Suggs puts up a performance that, last I checked from a couple of different people, the last people to put up like an 18-10-8 was like Dwayne Wade at Marquette when they beat Kentucky in 03 to get to the Final Four. That's how great Jalen Suggs is. And I've told people this. I would not be hesitant if I need a guard to take Suggs number one, because to me he's impactful on all areas of the floor. Not that Cunningham isn't, but to me I've been more impressed with the consistency of Jalen Suggs night in and night out. You rarely see him have a bad game on the floor. And right now, Gonzaga is just cooking on all cylinders with a 19-point victory, or clicking on all cylinders. And UCLA beats Michigan. That was the big surprise. We know Michigan would struggle without Isaiah Livers, but they actually had relatively easy success. I was surprised they beat Florida State the way they did. But give the UCLA defense a lot of credit. Michigan made just 3 of 11 threes, shot about 39%. Now, UCLA couldn't score. Johnny Juzang had 28 of their 51 points. But UCLA was just hitting baskets down the stretch, and that was the difference in this ball game. I mean, you could blame Juwan Howard for a couple things, but in the end, Michigan got really good looks. But Franz Wagner airballed a three, was just 1 for 10 from the floor. And by the time Michigan finally realized, give the ball to Hunter Dickinson down low, was a little bit too late. You look at Michigan's guards, scoring a combined 15 points between three players, that's not going to win games. It's still a successful year for Michigan. Juwan Howard won Coach of the Year. I don't think a lot of people expected Michigan to be where they were coming into the year. And the future's bright for Juwan Howard there. But you got to give Mick Cronin a lot of credit. And I think you got to respect Mick Cronin because a lot of people did not like that hire. We're actually going to have the student beat writer for the Daily Bruin, Sam Connan, coming on the show. He is down in Indianapolis. We'll preview the matchup with Gonzaga with him. And I remember looking at that hire, and people hated the Mick Cronin hire. Not a traditional hire, not going to work, he doesn't preach offense, it's not a pretty style of basketball. It doesn't matter. I remember Mick Cronin because I was a St. John's student when Mick Cronin was in Cincinnati, when they were in the Big East. And you always were worried about Cincinnati's tough-nosed style of basketball. And he's kind of brought that to Los Angeles. It's a different UCLA team. I kind of look at them like the Yankees of 2017. If you remember, if you're not that huge of a baseball fan, the Yankees were like UCLA in baseball. The team you love, either you love or you hate, there's no in-between. And you usually hate them. UCLA was like that when the Yankees were in 2017, when they were on the... They traded everybody away. They traded away Chapman, traded away Beltran, and traded away Andrew Miller. And the Yankees going into 2017 had no expectation. And they got to the Game 7 of the ALCS before losing to the Astros. And during that run, people that didn't usually like the Yankees were liking the Yankees because they had youth on the team. They had Aaron Judge. They had Gary Sanchez. And those guys were all relatively new where people could be like, yeah, I want to root for them because they're fun. They're young. They're not the Yankees buying championships. This isn't UCLA having their dynasty run. This isn't even UCLA of recent years with Russell Westbrook and Kevin Love. It's UCLA being back. And that is so huge for the Pac-12. We talked to the Pac-12 in recent weeks about how it's been down and how the perception is bad nationally, I think, for a couple different reasons. But one of them is because Arizona's out of the tournament and UCLA has been bad for years. And now that UCLA is in the Final Four, maybe that changes things. When you look at the Pac-12 for the women, and we briefly talked about that Final Four, Arizona and Stanford playing for the national championship. Arizona, the three seed, beat Connecticut in the Final Four on Friday night. And Gino Auriemma has lost four straight semifinal games. I mean, that alone is eye-opening when you consider how many national championships Gino's won. But you have a Pac-12 national championship, Stanford and Arizona. So the Pac-12 is starting to gain that respect. You don't necessarily become the best conference in America from doing great in one tournament, but you gain that respect back. And at the very least, UCLA has that. Now, going into today, Gonzaga is a 14-point favorite. I'm not sure, and that's the late game tonight, about 8:30, 8:40, depending on whatever time the game ends here. And I just don't know how UCLA can keep up. Gonzaga's got a good amount of depth. We've talked about that throughout the tournament. I think they're going to need Juzang and Hawkins to have huge games. Problem is Gonzaga, just their offense is so dynamic, and they have different guys that can beat you at a different time. I don't think UCLA's played an offense like that, although they did beat Alabama in overtime. It's very tough for UCLA, I think, to hang in this game. I think they'll be around for about first 10, 12 minutes. I could see that being close. The problem is Gonzaga just constantly pulls away in the second half. We saw it against Oklahoma. Creighton even gave him a decent half, and Gonzaga pulled away. Same with the USC game. USC starts off okay, and then Gonzaga just wipes the floor with them in a 3-4-minute stretch. I think that's the case you get here. They're going to feed the ball to Timmy in the paint. What you saw from UCLA, if they can get Cody Riley into foul trouble, Gonzaga should have an easy time in the front court. Because we saw Dickinson have a huge matchup advantage in the second half. Gonzaga can just feed the paint. And then if you feed the paint and draw the double team, you kick it out to Kispert, kick it out to Suggs, and you hit some shots that way. So I think to me, Gonzaga is going to win this game. and advance on to be one win away from being the first. I do think eventually Gonzaga is going to cut down the nets. I said it before the tournament. It's one of the only, my only Final Four team I have left. And I had them winning the whole thing. I don't see how they don't win the whole thing. And I think that starts tonight with a win over UCLA. Now, the first game, 5:14 p.m. Eastern on CBS, Houston and Baylor, the battle for Texas. And I think there's only one way Houston wins this game. They've got to make it ugly. If Baylor gets in the 70s, they win this game. If you're Houston, you've got to win this game in the 60s. You've got to ugly this game up defensively, and Houston's one of the better defensive teams in the country at 56 points per game against allowed. Baylor's at about 60. So both these teams can play pretty good defense. The problem I see with Houston, though, I think the Cougars have a little more depth going in. I think they have a decent amount of depth, but I think Baylor's just got too much. I mean, we talked about those guys earlier, the Teagues, the Mitchells, the Butlers. Baylor's just got too good a guard play. And I think that's going to determine the win here. I think this game, though, I'm very intrigued by it. I think it's going to be really close. Baylor's about a five-point favorite. I think Houston can cover that number. I can see it come down in the last couple possessions. I think people giving more respect to Houston now. They probably looked at them going in, even though they were a two seed, and said, three loss in the American, nothing really changes. It's going to be an early exit. But in the end, I think it will be a Gonzaga-Baylor national championship, which we talked about at the beginning of the tournament. This matchup was postponed in December due to COVID. It's only fitting that these have been the two best teams in college basketball all season long, and we finally get it for the national championship on Monday night. And it'll be must-see TV. I think Baylor's the team that can best compete with Gonzaga right now, and I think it'll be a classic national championship, but I think Gonzaga will win. Take a look at some of the coaching decisions or carousel. It's been really crazy when you look at college basketball coaching. And I'm going to start with coaches who have retired and then move on to coaches that have taken new jobs. And we got to start with Roy Williams, who stepped down as the head coach of North Carolina, 48 seasons as a coach. He was a college coach for 33 years. I first remembered him from getting the job at Kansas and thinking about how in 2003, when Kansas lost to Syracuse in the national championship with that Carmelo Anthony, Jerry McNamara team. Everyone was always talking about how Roy Williams couldn't get it done, couldn't win the big game. Then he goes to North Carolina, wins three national championships, 2005, 2009, and recently 2017. He has taken teams to the tournament at least 30 times, nine Final Fours. He has the second most NCAA tournament wins with 79, third in NCAA tournament winning percentage. He's had 12 30-win seasons, 29 20-win seasons. I know it was a down year for North Carolina, still got them to the tournament this year. What a run for Roy Williams. And we'll see what North Carolina does as head coach, because they have some good candidates internally, Wes Miller and Hubert Davis, who could be good hires. I mean, and externally, this is a really good job. There's no turmoil with this job. It's a place you could easily win. You got to make the right hire. But I think it's more appealing than we talked about the Indiana job back before Mike Woodson got it. I'll get into why I think Mike Woodson could work in a little bit. But I think there's more appeal to coaching in North Carolina. You're not following Dean Smith or something like that, the late Dean Smith. So it's not as if like you have to worry. You do have to follow a legend in Roy Williams. But you are able to win in North Carolina. Everything is set up for you to win. So anybody can get this job. I think anybody can feel confident in this job. So I'm really interested to see if it's external. If it's internal, I think it'll be Hubert Davis. But we'll see what happens with that. Now I'm going to get to the Indiana job first with Mike Woodson. And I know a lot of people hated this hire. It's an NBA hire. Mike Woodson was an alum of Indiana. I like it. And people say, well, Mike Woodson doesn't know recruiting, and he might not. He's trying to get the staff together, and Thad Matta, former Ohio State coach, can help him out with that. I think Mike Woodson can relate to players, because keep this in mind. Mike Woodson is probably best known right now as the coach that's made the Knicks their only good team in the last 20 years before this year. That's relatable to people. Like, this guy actually made the Knicks good. Albeit he had Carmelo Anthony, but hey, actually made them a decent team. So there is value to that, and Mike Woodson is at least a recognizable face. Can he coach college? We don't know. But think about the Indiana job situation. Nobody wanted this job. No big-time college coach wanted this job. Brad Stevens didn't want this job. It's a tough place to win right now. A lot of pressure at Indiana. So you were not going to get the big, big, sexy hire. Mike Woodson's a good hire. I think he's definitely a really good coach. Now, can he recruit? We'll find out. But I like the move. A couple other interesting coaching hires. Chris Beard goes to Texas from Texas Tech. That one I found intriguing because I didn't really ever think a guy from Texas Tech would go to Texas. Because you got to go back there now and be and basically kind of be the public enemy number one in Texas. You probably get booed when fans come back into that arena. But if Chris Beard can accept that, he'll be in a good shape. No, he was a student assistant at Texas, so he is familiar with that from 91 to 95. Went to Texas, so kind of, I guess the appeal of going back to coaching at your alma mater is always great, and Texas is a really good job. But again, we talk about Indiana. Texas has those same high expectations. Like, where Shaka Smart can have good regular seasons, but you're terrible in the NCAA tournament, that goes a long way. Then you have Porter Moser, who I never thought was going to leave Loyola, especially after he almost took the St. John's job a couple years ago, decided not to go. And instead, he goes to Oklahoma. Lon Kruger retired, and a great hire by Joe Castiglione. I think we found out that Moser's a really good coach. It was not a fluke that Loyola Chicago got to the Final Four, took this team to the Sweet 16, was arguably one of their, arguably better than that team, even though they lost to Oregon State. And you saw that they tried really hard to get him back. Matt Norlander from CBS tweeted that they were offering him cup season tickets and $2.2 million and one of the better offers for mid-major coaches ever. I'm sure it was tough for him to leave. And we know it was tough for him to leave when he almost took the St. John's job. I can't imagine. I think the Oklahoma job has more of a national appeal than the St. John's job does. But overall, I think when you look at the Oklahoma hire, I mean, they were looking at him and I think the coach at Abilene Christian. I think Oklahoma got this hire right. And you look at the landscape of college basketball right now. So many players in the transfer portal. I'm looking at my school, St. John's, and Mike Anderson, where he's going to have, he's lost six or seven players, most of them to the transfer portal. I'm not here to argue that players shouldn't want to transfer because they're not getting enough playing time or certain personal situations. Everybody's transfer situation is different. And I totally side with players who feel, hey, the coach can leave whenever they want. Why can't I leave whenever they want? I totally get that. I'm not opposed to thinking that way in a different form. But think of it this way. Think of how now college basketball, the coach basically has to re-recruit you every single season. And you kind of make a commitment when you sign your national letter of intent to go to that school. And there is some form of way of honoring that commitment. Could the NCAA, in a sense, make it where you can allow to be transferred one time? And then if you want a chance for the second time, you have to sit out. That could be the case. I wouldn't be opposed to that rule because there is something to saying, look, I'm going back and I'm going to school and I'm trying to go to school for 3-4 years, whatever it is. Could that change when eventually the NBA goes back to the one to you can go to high school, right, go to the NBA right out of high school and it doesn't matter what you do for college? Yeah. That could probably change it. I don't have sympathy for the coaches because, again, they could leave whenever they want. They could take these buyouts and you go to play for, let's say, Chris Beard. You go to play for Chris Beard at Texas Tech, and now he goes to Texas. You go to Loyola to play for Porter Moser. Now he's at Oklahoma. Now, Loyola Chicago did hire an assistant on Porter Moser's staff. Maybe that helps things there for the Ramblers. But the system is going to change drastically, especially with the name, image, and likeness things. You had Mark Emmert, who is really under hot water because he takes a call with a couple of men's players, not any women's players. So Mark Emmert's done a really bad job in this whole process. And it's tough to get to trust what the NCAA does, which is why you side with the players in most of these cases when the coaches, again, the players don't get a big piece of the NCAA tournament pie or the college football playoff pie when you look at all that money that comes in. So you tend to have more sympathy for them than you do the coaches. But again, if you are a coach, you basically have to re-recruit your players every year. And that's a hard thing to do. Because you kind of go in with this plan of like, all right, I have this many people for this for the next 2-3 years. You can't go in that way right now. And it makes for the whole college basketball landscape can instantly change when you get a transfer or two. Because of the impact they can have right away on your team. So it's just something to keep an eye on. Because I found that, I think, really interesting this week. So coming up next, I'm going to be joined by Sam Connan, who is the men's basketball beat writer for the UCLA student newspaper, The Daily Broom. We talk UCLA. We talk Mick Cronin. We talk about his piece on the Daily Broom website about Throwback Thursday. This is the, when we recorded this, it was Thursday. It was the, was it, when, it was Wednesday or Thursday? I think it was Thursday. It was the Adam Morrison revenge game. 15 years ago, remember Gus Johnson, Adam Morrison with Gonzaga, blows a big lead, J.P. Batista, UCLA rallies from, I think, a 20 down to win the game. We kind of get back into that a little bit. Kind of a great memory of the tournament. We have some fun along the way with that and talking about the Pac-12's national perception. So stay tuned for that interview. Then we'll come back. We'll do a little baseball. My thoughts on opening day, my predictions, and, of course, the decision by Major League Baseball to pull the All-Star game out of Atlanta for this season. You're listening to Kingdom of the Keeler on the Full Press Radio Network. We will be right back. Final Four is this weekend in Indianapolis, and there's 2-1 seeds, a 2 seed, and an 11 seed that most years the 11 seed is the underdog and the lovable Cinderella. Don't know if they are Cinderella, but we'll talk about the UCLA Bruins, and to do that, we're joined by one of the sports senior staff writer for the UCLA student newspaper, The Daily Bruin, who is on the beat for the men's basketball team, and he's in Indianapolis. Sam Connan is here on Kicking with Keeler. Sam, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Ricky. Thanks for having me on.
Happy to have you. So first off, I just want to get your thoughts on this crazy run UCLA has been on this season. Just give me your thoughts. Did you think back in December that UCLA had a chance to be where they are this weekend?
You know, it's funny. I think right as the season started, I put out a poll on Twitter just saying, who do you think is more likely to make the Final Four, UCLA men's basketball, UCLA women's basketball, or both? Kind of as a joke because both teams were looking pretty good. They were ranked preseason. But at the same time, I didn't really think either would happen. And then December when Chris Smith tears his ACL, that kind of put a huge damper on the season. They go on, they win six in a row after that, so they're playing really well in Pac-12 play. The hope at that point is that they can get a good seed, but not really a Final Four. That still really wasn't in the picture. And then when they end the regular season as poorly as they did, then people were just felt good to be there. It's where the fan base with 11 championships was just happy to be in March Madness.
Yeah, I think that's the fun part of it is I kind of relate to the Yankees in 2017 for another sport is that you tend to hate UCLA, either love UCLA or hate UCLA. And now everyone just, it's probably weird. Everybody's liking the Bruins outside of Southern California. But even then, USC was an Elite Eight team anyway. So it was like UCLA's in that position where now everybody's rooting for them when everybody used to hate their guts all the time.
Yeah, and I think part of the reason is the fact that this is a very different UCLA team. The last time they made a Final Four was with Kevin Love, who was one of the top recruits in the country, player of the year. You had Darren Collison and Russell Westbrook and Luke Richard, Mbamute Mute, all these guys who are future NBA guys. And yeah, you probably have a few of those guys on this year's team too, but you probably wouldn't have said that 3 weeks ago. Before this big tournament run, a lot of people from the outside would have said this team doesn't have any NBA talent. So that's why a lot of outsiders or people who haven't been following the team from day one I think look at this UCLA team as different and as more of a lovable underdog. I like that Yankees comparison you bring up because it's almost like that year the Yankees, they had kind of tanked the year before. They weren't really supposed to be good. And then Aaron Judge gets there and he's really good. And Gleyber Torres and all these young guys were a lot better than expected earlier than expected. And I think that's what UCLA is getting going now because they don't have any seniors, but they strung it together. These guys are all hitting their stride at the right time. And I think that's something that people love to see every March. And this year it's UCLA who fills that role.
See, when I was at St. John's, Cincinnati was in the Big East, and I was always a big fan of Nick Cronin as a head coach, just the style he coaches, the consistency that his team's always had at Cincinnati. You knew what you were getting when you played the Bearcats. I know that a lot of people out West did not like when UCLA hired Mick Cronin. So I'll ask you, as somebody who covers the team and talks to Mick Cronin consistently, what do you like most about covering him, and how do you think that this team has sort of taken to his coaching this year?
Yeah, just covering him. I was there day one when he got hired. I was there at his introductory press conference. Feels like forever ago, but he still is the same guy that he was in April of 2019 when he got hired. He came in energetic and funny. He's a guy who makes a lot of one-liners, cracks a lot of jokes. Like, he's very disciplined as a coach, but when he talks to the media, when he's very deliberately warm, which is something that's enjoyable to cover because he'll give you good quotes and doesn't make you feel like a jerk all the time. It's funny comparing him to covering other teams. Certain coaches that will go unnamed on UCLA football who maybe are a little more standoffish with the media, it just makes Mick look all the better. So he's been great to have around, easy to work with, easy to cover. And I think the team, it's a different personality that he takes on in the locker room, but it seems like these guys have really taken to him as well. It may be in a different way, maybe in the same way, but they all bought in. That's something that he's talked about a lot. He said, so UCLA only has two freshmen on this team. They had two last year that Cronin didn't even recruit. So he's said this a lot. He said it when he got here. He's saying it now again, that there's always a narrative when you get a new coach saying, oh, he's playing his guys. He doesn't have his guys yet, so X, Y, Z. And Cronin made sure to tell his players when he came in the door day one, hey, you can transfer if you want. You don't have to be here if you don't want. If you stay, though, you're my guy. I don't care if I didn't recruit you. I don't care if I wasn't the coach when you signed here. You are my player. I'm your coach. And I really credit the team for buying in from day one. Everyone on that team pretty much who committed to Cronin is still around now, and it's built up for 2 years. You had the big, really successful end to last season and obviously a Final Four run this year. It's great to see the guys really connect with Cronin and his staff the way they have.
One player that I think maybe has been a breakout star to people east of the Mississippi is Johnny Uzang, who had 28 against Michigan, 11 for 19 shooting, has had double figures now in six straight games. But he was doing this kind of – he had these kind of performances during the season, I'm sure. But what has stood out to you about Uzang in this tournament, especially – you could basically say, I know the defense gets a lot of credit. We'll get into that Michigan win in a little bit. But Uzang was essentially the offense of that win over Michigan on Tuesday.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 28 out of their 51 points came from him. So that it's obviously a pretty important performance. But you look at the way they used Juzang through most of the season, and it's interesting because he scored over 25 points three times in the regular season. And in those games, UCLA went 1-2. So it's not like it was his fault for being too ball dominant or hogging the ball or anything. It's not like that led to his loss, those losses for UCLA, but he was kind of being used as a crutch once Chris Smith went out for the offense, because he was one of the only guys who could create his own shot. So when the offense wasn't working, they just give it to Juzang because no one else knows what to do. And that gave Juzang a lot of opportunities to test out his repertoire on offense, take some good shots, take some bad shots maybe. So that period where he was being relied on as the number one scorer so heavily helped him kind of hone his craft, hone his scoring abilities. That's something Cronin talked about after the Michigan game, where he's not just a shooter like he was at Kentucky now. He's a scorer now. And I think putting him through that gauntlet in January and February, where he was the entire offense and they let him run the show, I think that did wonders for him. And now you're seeing it pay off, where now he can make those tough shots. Teams are denying him the ball because he's playing so well. And that helps his teammates who had been over-reliant on Juzang earlier in the season. When they deny Juzang the ball and focus so much on him, that opens things up for his teammates. And it just ended up all really working out, and the timing was great for UCLA when it comes to Juzang in the offense.
Watching this Bruins team throughout the tournament, one of the guys I feel like he doesn't really score a lot, but the one guy I seem to always see making a play is Tiger Campbell. Talk about the spark he tends to bring with his passing and his ability to open up the floor for some of these playmakers on the UCLA offense.
Yeah, I think Tiger Campbell is pretty much the dictionary definition of a floor general. He always talks about how he's the mouthpiece for coach on the floor, as a point guard usually is. But for him, it works especially well, whether they're running sets, whether he's running pick and rolls. He's got a really good command for the offense. He's absolutely elite when it comes to assist turnover ratio. This season actually was slightly better than last season, but last season during that big winning streak to end the season, it was something like 7-1 assist to turnover during that winning streak. And he's kind of putting on a similar show in March Madness, maybe not to that statistical level, but he's the kind of guy who can call out plays, has really good vision, run a good pick and roll, even though he doesn't have a great pick and roll partner right now. But he's a mouthpiece for the coach. He fits the ball into tight windows. He doesn't turn the ball over. He really checks off all the boxes. And the only problem with him is that he's the only true point guard on the team. So he's had to play a lot of minutes all season long, hasn't missed a game. He's usually a lot of times up by 35 minutes. And you would worry that a guy like that gets a little worn out, but he's just as good now as he was at the beginning of the season. So that's good to see, because UCLA needs him to run the offense, and because they go so half court reliant, running such a slow pace, that they need him to really be the coach on the floor and run that offense to success for most of the game.
We know Mick Cronin has that defensive coaching style, but going up against Michigan, who even without Isaiah Liver still has a ton of talent, how shocked were you that not only did UCLA win that game, but held Michigan under 50 points when they're one of the better offenses in the Big Ten this year?
Yeah, I was definitely surprised, because you look at the road that UCLA had before the Michigan game, and it was always a pretty – maybe it was a tall task, but it was a simple cut and dry – this is how you beat this team. You beat Abilene Christian by not turning the ball over. You beat BYU and Alabama by stopping the three. You beat Michigan State by slowing down Aaron Henry. When it came to Michigan, with Isaiah Livers out, who's really their number one guy, and then looking at how efficient their offense and defense was going into that game, there wasn't really a blueprint for how to beat Michigan. So I was surprised they won, but especially winning the way they did, like you said, holding them to 49, it was insane, with Cody Riley being in foul trouble. I actually think that was almost purposeful. They're using their bigs defensively in a way they hadn't been before. Cody Riley had fewer minutes than Kenny Mubah the other night, which never happens. Mubah was barely in the rotation for most of the season, but the way they're defending bigs, the way they're doubling bigs and rotating on the perimeter, chasing guys off the three-point line, it worked against Alabama. I didn't know it was going to work against Michigan, but it worked there too. Their big men are picking up hard fouls, and they're really spreading those out through Hawkes and through Nwuba and Riley. So they aren't overly reliant on one guy and he fouls out early. Now you can have guys in foul trouble, but you use those fouls to your advantage. You get physical. Even if you're not the most efficient defensive team, if you look at KenPom or any different rating system, you can be physical and you can use those fouls. You have five per player and they're really making the most of them.
So we know UCLA is a massive underdog in this game, whether right now it's 14 points as we record this. So I'm sure you've looked at this all week. How does UCLA beat what some feel is the most dominant team in the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years in Gonzaga? What from looking at it, what's the blueprint for UCLA?
Okay, this is going to sound really weird, but to beat Gonzaga, you have to play like you're playing Abilene Christian, which doesn't make a ton of sense, but Abilene Christian forced a ton of turnovers. That's how they beat Texas in the first round. UCLA took care of the ball, and they pretty much wiped the floor with Abilene Christian. They didn't even have to shoot that well, but just by taking care of the ball, that did wonders for them. Gonzaga has the sixth fastest pace in Division I. If you look at KenPom, they get out in transition. That's how they built an early lead against USC the other night, was by forcing all those turnovers early. And they're really good at it. And it's not just their guards. It's their big men. It's Kispert and it's Timmy, who are athletic and dynamic bigs and who have a lot of finesse and can run the fast break. So step number one to the laundry list of what it would take to beat Gonzaga is don't let them get out in transition. Play your pace. Force them to play at your pace, playing in the half court, low possession games. That's how they beat Michigan. It's how they beat Alabama. It's how they beat Abilene Christian. And they're going to need to do it again against one of the best teams in the country on Saturday.
So give me an X factor then for this game. Who's one player that doesn't get a lot of attention that you think could play a big factor here?
Ooh, I think I'm going to go with Jake Kyman. He's a small forward shooting guard, really just a shooting specialist for UCLA. Hasn't really gotten going in March Madness yet. But if you look at his freshman year last year, and even at times this year, he has his moments where he can't miss. And this year, they've kind of alleviated that pressure by bringing in a shooting scorer like Chuzang. But when they run plays for Jake Kyman and he gets going and he's hot, that's what UCLA needs. They need little two-minute bursts where they can get 9 points out of a guy. Because either they're going to be playing catch-up and they need to do that, or they need to build some kind of a lead and they need to do that. You have to score to beat Gonzaga. I mean, you have to score to beat anyone, but Gonzaga is going to put up a lot of points. You're going to have to keep up. You're going to have to score a lot of points yourself if you have any hope at winning. And obviously that's going to take Juzang, a lot of effort from him, Jules Bernard, all these other guys. But I'm looking at those bench guys, those bench shooters, whether it's Jake Kyman or David Singleton, they're going to need a good amount of three-point shooting off their bench. It was David Singleton against Alabama. I'm going to go Jake Kyman against Gonzaga.
So do you think the chances are they actually pull this upset? Would you actually pick UCLA to make this upset?
Ooh, I don't know about that. The funny thing, I've picked against them for most of this tournament. I thought I was being generous by putting them in the round of 32. I thought they'd lose to Texas, but I mean, I thought they'd beat Abilene Christian, but I picked against them when they were playing Alabama. I picked against them when they were playing Michigan, and I'm going to pick against them now too, just because Gonzaga is one of the best teams of the last 30 years. Maybe if it closes out, they'll be the first undefeated team in 40, 50 years. That's insane. So even though UCLA pulled off unexpected wins against really good teams, they're about to go head-to-head with an all-time team. So it's not impossible. Nothing's impossible in March. They pulled off some great upsets to get to where they are now. So anything's in the cards. I'd give them maybe a 10% chance. I think the line, the 14-point line you were talking about is pretty daunting. But I would say I'll give them a 10% chance to win, but I'll say UCLA either wins or they don't cover. Because I feel like if they get it close enough where they're being physical and it's a tight game down the stretch, the way that UCLA has been playing, the way they've had experience in close games, I think might give them a leg up over Gonzaga, who's so used to blowing teams out. So I don't think their chances at winning are great, but if they're covering that 14-point spread, I'd pick them to win. I know it's a little a weird prediction to make, but that's what I'm going with.
So let me get into some general topics with you about UCLA. And I want to look at the Pac-12 because this is the first time we've had a chance to talk to somebody who goes to a Pac-12 school and covers a Pac-12 team. What do you make of the Pac-12's kind of the disrespect they got throughout the season, do you feel some of it was warranted? Do you feel that a lot of people weren't paying attention to the Pac-12 and how good it was? And do you think that'll change based off how all these teams played in this tournament?
First off, I don't think it'll change. As promising as this tournament run has been for the Pac-12 and as successful as it's been, I don't think it's going to change the major sticking points that people in the Midwest and out East have against the Pac-12. Some warranted, some unwarranted, but a lot of it goes back to, and I'm originally from Boston. I'm from the East Coast. I know what it's like to have that mindset. There are just going to be so many people who don't watch these West Coast games. Even when UCLA had Lonzo Ball or Oregon was going to Final Fours in 2017, whenever that was, they still were maybe not the most popular team. So that's always going to work against them. And so it is what it is. That's when it comes to the talking heads or fans. I don't count it against them when they don't know Pac-12 basketball or they discount them. I'm a little more disappointed in AP voters, in the tournament committee, the selection committee, because that's the responsibility. They need to keep an eye on the West Coast, the Pac-12, to know the kind of talent that's actually out there. I'm glad they put it on display in the tournament. I don't think it's going to change things in the bigger picture. At the same time, I don't think having the most Elite Eight teams and the most Sweet 16 teams means they're the best conference. They just need to be put on the same level as the Big Ten and the ACC, the Big East and everything. They're great. They're really talented top to bottom. I mean, every conference has its stinkers. Every conference has its powerhouses. The Pac-12 is no different. No one besides Bill Walton is saying that the Pac-12 is the best conference in the country. It's just they're a Power Five. They deserve to be treated on the same level as all the others. And over the past couple of years, they haven't been.
Well, I think here's the issue for the Pac-12, and I think it's really a couple of things. Being off on the East Coast, I think I kind of thought about this a little bit. I think, one, the network that a lot of their games are on, half the people in the country don't have.
It's horrible. I hate it.
that's one of the issues. I think people, honestly, as much as I like Bill Walton, kind of tuned in to hear what Bill Walton says other than watching the game itself. And then the third reason, I think it's a big one, and UCLA's success might be a good reason why it bounces back. UCLA hasn't been that good since Ben Howland and Steve Lavin in those days, so that people tend to not pay attention. And Arizona has been down this season and had some turmoil with Sean Miller still. So I think when those two schools are down and Washington hasn't been that good and the traditional good Pac-12 schools are down, people aren't going to pay attention that much.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So that's the argument for the Pac-12 getting a good boost nationally from this tournament run from the conference. So I hope that's true. I hope that this tournament run means that UCLA is back, that USC is a power, and that Oregon is where it is. I mean, Oregon's been a great team for a while now. I think they're the one team who is really severely underseeded. UCLA was where they was because they ended the season so cold. USC had its ups and downs. They were probably a little underseeded. Colorado was where it was. And Oregon State had to be at 12. That just kind of is how it is. Oregon had the talent of probably a 3 seed. And they stuck him at a 7. So that's the one sticking point that I feel like when UCLA is good, when Arizona is good, they're going to get the high seeds. They're going to get the praise. But schools like USC and Oregon who aren't basketball powers, they need to get the respect from the AP voters, from the selection committee, because you look at, I mean, like Rutgers and Maryland aren't powers, but because they're in the Big Ten, they got a lot more respect this year than they usually do. Oregon, USC has to be the same kind of thing. And Oregon especially is a great basketball program. USC is just, I don't want to say they're on the come up, but they are kind of ascending. So it's the balance is always weird because you don't want to be too top heavy, but at the same time, you're definitely reliant on those big programs for the eyeballs, for the attention.
So on the Daily Bruin website, you looked back at an event. I think when I saw this matchup, I thought back to 15 years ago, and I thought about this being the Adam Morrison revenge game poor Gonzaga. I don't know if the Zags would invite him out to India or if he'd actually go if he was allowed to. But take me through that article, and you noticed – I noticed you brought up a point that something Ben Hallen said reminded you of something Mick Cronin said Tuesday. Tell listeners about it.
Yeah, so just going back to that game in 2006, UCLA beat Gonzaga in the Sweet 16. There was the crazy two steals at the end, 17-point comeback. It's just an all-timer. I think they were showing it during COVID last year when there wasn't anything on TV. It's a classic. But after the game, Ben Howland was during his press conference was asked about the team, the effort they put in, how it kind of came together, and he just went on and complimented his players about their toughness and their grit and the never give up attitude. And it going back and reading articles from then and watching press conferences from then, it was a very sharp parallel, very clear parallel to me with what Howland said at the end of that game, coming back from down 17 to beat Gonzaga, to what Mick Cronin's been saying after the Alabama game, after the Michigan game, really complimenting his players for the grinded out style of basketball they've been playing. It was a little higher scoring against Alabama, and it was a little lower scoring against Michigan, but they're making the winning plays. And it's always weird to talk about those intangibles in these big sweeping broad statements, but when these coaches do it a lot of the time, they're kind of right, where it doesn't really always matter what's on the stat sheet, but these guys are being physical. They're grinding it out, and this team probably isn't as good as that 2006 team was or as good as the 2008 team was, but they're playing a similar style basketball to those Ben Howland teams where they're kind of winning ugly, and that's okay because a win's a win.
So last question for you, Sam. I've asked this to all the student sports reporters we've had on since the start of the tournament. What's it been like covering a school like UCLA amidst a pandemic, and what have you learned from it?
Well, this is my third season covering the team, and it's my first March Madness because UCLA was pretty bad in 2019, missed the tournament, and last year COVID canceled it. So it was kind of weird at the beginning of all this, at the beginning of the tournament. I didn't travel out to Indy for the first couple rounds. Wasn't sure how long they were going to be there, but once I saw they were in the Sweet 16, I talked to my editor, the editor-in-chief, everyone at the UCLA student media, and they were all fully on board for me to come out, and it's just been a great experience to be out here, to be here in person with games, with fans, something that I hadn't experienced since the pandemic started. So it's been great. It's been great to have the access I have to be able to come out here for a big moment like this. It's UCLA in my 4 years, I mean, I'm graduating this spring, has been pretty bad at men's basketball and football. And it's fun to see this culmination right as I'm heading out. The men's basketball team is kind of hitting a peak, and I love to see that. It's fun to cover. It gives me more experience on a bigger stage, and I love that. But it's just fun to be there for, fun energy, fun guys to cover, fun guys to talk to. And it's just top to bottom, it's been a great experience.
I won't say if people tell you about the glory days of John Wooden, but I was thinking more of the recent. Do people always try to bring up, like, I remember, like, Steve Lavin as the coach and, like, how can even Steve Alford making Sweet 16s and just the people? How often are the good old days mentioned when you attend UCLA and the school has been as down as it's been in basketball up until this year?
It's funny because like you said, bringing up all those eras of varying success, depending on who you talk to, there's different good old days. Like talking to beat writers from other papers who have been around a while, it was the Howland years, talking to other people who've covered the team. It was those Steve Lavin years where they were relevant and they were good. And then it's funny, I showed up my freshman year, right at the start of that first basketball season was when all the China stuff happened and kind of blew things up for that year. But talking to people who had been around, I show up on campus fall of 2017, everyone else who's there was there for the Lonzo year. And to a lot of people there, that's the good old days, was the Lonzo Ball Sweet 16, which I know a lot of people are completely right saying they probably should have done more with that team. But the different peaks and valleys of UCLA men's basketball are really interesting. And it's fun that I'm kind of experiencing one now, because for the past couple of weeks, I didn't think I'd get to see any good old days, but who knows? Maybe at this point I can tell kids coming in to UCLA the next couple of years that I was there for the good old days of the beginning of the Cronin era or something like that.
I mean, who's to say the good old days can't continue? You don't have to be good old days. You can just say the era you're in now.
Exactly. That's the that idea.
But Sam, thanks again for hopping on. Tell listeners out there about the Daily Brew and the coverage you're doing down over in Indy for the Final Four, and how they can follow you and the paper on Twitter.
Yeah, so I'm working for the Daily Bruin. They're on Twitter at Daily Bruin. I'm on Twitter at Sam Connan. And then, yeah, I've been in here in Indy since last Saturday, covering the team, throwing up previews, scouting reports, wraps, working on a few other things with other student journalists, looking back in time at some other old games. I'm tweeting all those out on my Twitter. You can go to dailybruin.com. We got a little tag up at the top for all our March Madness stories. So if you're interested in reading any of those ahead of the Gonzaga game on Saturday or even after, you can go there and see what I've been working on.
Yeah, I recommend reading Sam's Throwback Thursday while having the Gus Johnson clip in the background. I think that would just – you get your reading and your listening – all into one, but Sam puts up really good scouting reports. So I was checking it out for the Michigan game. They're very detailed. So be sure to check out all the work that he's doing before Saturday night's matchup, 8:30, 8:40 Eastern, whenever it is, against Gonzaga. Should be a fun game. Sam, again, thanks for hopping on. Keep up the great work. Best of luck down in Indy, and thanks for hopping on. We appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate the invite, Ricky.
Special thanks to Sam Connan from the Daily Bruin for hopping on the show to talk about UCLA Gonzaga later tonight. Looking forward to a great Final Four. Looking forward to what should be a fun, especially if it's Gonzaga Baylor, a fun Monday night national championship game. And it'll be great to hear one shining moment again after what we didn't have a year ago due to the coronavirus pandemic. I want to remind you, of course, that we have a great live radio lineup every weekday here at Full Press Radio. We have FPC Radio Live every weekday at 8:30, I believe it is, or 9 o'clock with Ian Glendon and Mike DeBate. Then we have Snowman in the Morning with Brian Snow. We have College Credit Hour with Memphis Spence and Dylan and Ross Save Sports. That's our live lineup, which you get on the Full Press Coverage app or go to fullpresscoverage.com. We also have good live shows on our video format on Sportscaster. Which, again, you can sign up today, go to sportscaster.com, make your own account if you want to voice your opinions via video to the masses. So I want to talk about Major League Baseball. Of course, I'm a huge baseball fan. I was thrilled for opening day. Most everybody has played except the Mets and the Nationals, who had their opening series postponed. The Nationals had, I believe right now, it's 4 positive tests. And they're at total of 9 players in terms of that could not play due to close contact. Right now, it sounds like the Nationals will be able to play on Monday against the Atlanta Braves. The Mets will play Monday at Philadelphia, which will be their opener. And it's just a reminder that COVID is not in our rearview mirror yet. Even though it's great, we're getting vaccinated. I got my second shot of the vaccine last week, and it's still around us. It just didn't get up and walk away. You read people on Twitter and you'd say, well, why can't you just take your alternate site people and play the game? And I do think you look at the alternate site. I mean, that's why people are there, right, to play. But the problem I think you have with that is your teams want to use a lot of service time on those players. And you want to look out, again, for the health and safety of the athlete, first and foremost, until you figure out how wide the spread is. You can't play the games. And especially these being divisional games, they're easier to make up. So you don't have to worry about, let's say the Mets are playing the Pirates, right? You don't have to worry about fitting another trip into Pittsburgh. You're going to go to D.C. at some point again if you're the Mets. You're going to find a way to make this up at some point. Now, does it affect how you prepare going into the year? Yeah, of course it does. We'll see how Jacob DeGrom pitches on Monday because he was prepared to pitch Thursday. Same with Max Scherzer. Prepared to pitch Thursday against the Mets. Now he's pitched Monday against Atlanta. How does that kind of change everything in a sense? And you got to get off to a good start, especially if you're Washington. As Mike Rizzo said, their depth is going to be tested. We don't know which players are out, but you know they're going to have to use a lot of players from the alternate side or sign veteran free agents and try to make it work because we saw what the Marlins did and what the Cardinals did last year. A 60-game season had a COVID outbreak and still found a way to make the playoffs. Albeit expanded playoffs, but still found a way to make it. So I get why Met fans are frustrated because their team did nothing wrong and they're not playing because of the Nationals, but it's not like the Nationals went out and blatantly broke protocol either. We talked about this last year with the Marlins. I'm not going to get on a team if they caught COVID and nobody broke anything. Nobody broke any protocol. Nobody did what they weren't supposed to do. That's not for me to judge. It's not for anybody to judge. And we know that baseball has said that the restrictions can get eased if 85% of the team or tier one personnel get the vaccine, which I think Luis Rojas, from what I read, most of the Mets are eligible on Tuesday. So not being eligible for the vaccine or not getting the vaccine just yet, if you're looking to get it, and again, it's a personal decision, but that is also going to make still postponement of games and makeup of games and doubleheaders possible. It's just the reality that we're in. So hopefully everybody's okay in that situation. Again, right now it looks like the Nats will be back Monday against the Braves. The Mets will be back on Monday against the Phillies. So those two teams will get underway. But looking at what I've noticed so far in the regular season, and I'm going to get in my opening day takeaways a little bit later, Daniel Epstein, who is the co-founder of the IBWAA, also co-hosts the IBWA podcast, he joined me this week. So I did three opening day takeaways there. I don't want to kind of look back at that and kind of repeat it so you won't hear it a second time. So far, I'll just mention a couple of things, and then I'll talk about the Braves situation. I was very impressed so far by the Astros because I think you look at Houston, and remember, every team I think has a limited amount of fans at these games to start off with. And this is the first time the Astros have dealt with a semi-hostile crowd. And they've handled it really well. 8-1 win on Thursday. Friday night, a 9-5 win. Alex Bregman has two straight games and a home run. The Astros offense is clicking with Altuve and Brantley. And I think they're going to be more motivated than feared of trash can banging or fans getting on them or the hostile boos. That's going to thrive. That's going to make them thrive, I think, more than wither under the pressure. Because that's the persona that team has. They love being the villains. They love being the team nobody wants to see win. It makes them want to win more. We saw it last year in a bubble when the Astros were just two games under 500, yet we're almost about to pull off a 3-0 series comeback in the ALCS. And the AL West, I think, has gotten a lot weaker. Oakland, their pitching is still a big issue. The Angels, can they get enough starting pitching? Can we see some consistency from the Angels? I think so far the Angels have held their own early against the White Sox, though they got a rough outing from Andrew Haney last night, where Haney was just, after a quality start from Dylan Bundy on Thursday, Haney didn't really do anything to kind of pick up from that. He went three innings, allowed seven runs, five hits, struck out four, walked two. Not the kind of outing you need from your second starter in that situation. Seattle, I think, is a young team, and Texas is bad. I think we know that. So Houston right now, I've been very impressed with them in the first two games. White Sox, despite blowing the game on Thursday, I've been impressed with them, especially without Eloy Jimenez. They've been able to still put up runs at a good clip. Although Nick Madrigal's defense on Thursday is something to keep an eye on. San Diego's 2-0. I liked what they did. The weirdness of opening day with the Dodgers, where you had Cody Bellinger hit a home run, and then it wasn't a home run because Justin Turner thought it was an out. Or thought it was caught and went back, and Bellinger overran him, so it took the home run away. That was just a weird opening for the Dodgers. You're not going to pack on them too much because they're going to win more games than they don't. They're one of the better teams in the league. And you look at even that game for the Rockies. They only had one extra base hit off of Clayton Kershaw. yet Kershaw allowed 10 hits in that game and lost. So that was a weird, fluky Coors Field kind of game. We kind of saw a Coors Field kind of game on Friday. Trevor Bauer took a no-hitter into the seventh, and the Dodgers ended up winning that game 11-6. So that's the kind of weird games Coors Field brings to you. I've been very impressed by the Rays. Two good wins against the Marlins. Again, yes, it's the Marlins, but Tyler Glasnow and Sandy Alcantara had a great pitching duo in opening day. I don't think a lot of people watched. Ryan Yarbrough pitched in game two, went 5 2/3 scoreless innings. And the Rays bullpen, again, they just take a bunch of people and they piece it together. So while Kevin Cash isn't really a genius anymore, he at least is one of the better coaches. He's still playing chess. Everybody else is playing checkers. Now, one of the teams I'm not concerned with. You already get my thoughts on this, though, because I have to. And the other thing would probably be Luis Castillo getting up 6 runs in the first inning against the Cardinals, although that stood out on Thursday. The Yankees. Now, you know, I'm going to talk about the Yankees because I'm a Yankees fan, and I talk about the Yankees at Pinstripe Prospects podcast, Chasing 28, and the editor of Pinstripe Prospects. So you're going to get my thoughts on the Yankees more often than not. They lose opening day 3-2 in 10 innings against the Blue Jays. Toronto's a really good team. This was a fun pitching matchup between Gerrit Cole and Hyunjin Ryu, and both pitched really well. Even the bullpens for both these teams were good. Like, you saw Julian Merriweather save the game in the 10th inning with a man on second. By the way, I hate the man on second rule. I think it needs to be in the 12th or 13th inning, not in the 10th inning. I agree, at some point you have to have it just to keep pitching from being totally wiped out, but I think the 10th and even the 11th, you can still go a regular format. You're already playing 3.5 hours anyway. But Toronto wins 3-2 and 10, and I noticed Yankee fans, this is my PSA to Yankee fans, right? Gary Sanchez has a great game, hits a home run, throws out a base runner, draws a walk, does everything you could want him to do, so you can't boo him. You normally would boo him anyway. And I guess 10,000 fans being at the stadium, you haven't been at the stadium for a year, you're impatient, you want to win. I get it. They boo Giancarlo Stanton, who was 0-for-5 with a few strikeouts, had a bad day. I think people forgot Giancarlo Stanton homered 6 times in the playoffs last year. And almost, I won't say single-handedly, but close single-handedly, got the Yankees offense to the ALCS. So, I can't blame Stanton. You can't blame Stanton for every loss. And I get it, it's the A-Rod treatment part two, but you can't do that. A lot of what pressure's on the Yankees this season is on Aaron Judge. I still think Aaron Judge is a really good player. He lost on that game the other day. In the 7th and 9th inning, he had chances to give the Yankees the lead. He had hitters count and did a double play in the 7th and struck out in the 9th. And then in the 10th, misplayed the line drive by Grichuk. Yes, the sun was a factor, no doubt. Got over his head. Davis scores. Toronto wins the game. And I'll give Aaron Judge again credit. He's accountable every time that he makes mistakes. Says, it's on me that we lost this game. But I've heard that a lot from Aaron Judge over the years. And DJ LeMahieu did not have a good game either, but you know LeMahieu's going to hit. The thing with Judge, first off, you got to get through a whole season healthy or relatively healthy. And if you want to be that Yankee for life, I think it's unfair that fans get on Stanton so much, but they won't get on Aaron Judge. And I get why, because Aaron Judge is a homegrown Yankee, and you don't want to make him mad because then he's going to want to leave, and people see him as the next captain, quote-unquote. But Aaron Judge deserves his fair share of criticism. Everybody did most. Outside of Sanchez and maybe Clint Frazier, who had a great game with a couple of hits and a walk, and Mike Tauchman stealing 2 bases a pinch runner, everybody else deserved criticism for that game on Thursday. It was embarrassing. I texted my buddy Wayne during that game in the bottom of the 10th. I said, I guarantee the Yankees will strike out 3 in a row in the 10th. And they almost struck out by seeing 9 pitches. And as dominant as Merriweather was, that's embarrassing. So there's no panic for the Yankees. They're going to hit over the course of the regular season. They're going to hit with Mets in scoring position in the regular season. They're going to hit in the playoffs. I mean, they're going to get to the playoffs largely by over a course of 162. They're just better than a lot of people in the American League. But that game Thursday is a microcosm of why the Yankees come up short in October. They don't know how to score runs consistently when they're not hitting homers. They're a team that hits the 3-run homer. And again, do a lot of teams do that in baseball? Yes. Maybe it's a problem a lot of people have with the sport, where with men's scoring position, a review of first and third, one out, it's been very difficult for teams to hit a fly ball to drive and run on a sack fly or to do the little things. And the Yankees only have a couple of players in the team that you rely on to get the little things done. Guys like LeMahieu, I mean, Tauchman for pinch running and contact purposes, Tyler Wade usually. Urshela has kind of become that also. Torres is an all-around player, but and Hicks can draw walks. But a lot of the Yankees, what they have is that power strikeout guy. That's not changing. So that's the thing when you look at October, is what is this team going to be when they get there? And this is the kind of game you can look back on as a game like you're going to – you need to win more of these games than you lose to feel confident going into a short series in October. Which you could see a team like Toronto. Toronto's good. Their starting pitching is a question mark, but I think they're good. Now I want to get into – the situation in Atlanta. So the Major League Baseball makes a decision on Friday to take the All-Star Game and the draft out of Atlanta for this season. Now, the reason they're doing that is because of the bill that was in Georgia in which the I'm trying to get the right words here for this. There's the governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, signed a law that puts in restriction for voting by mail, how elections can be run. You can't give people food and water when they're waiting online to vote. I'm not going to get into the politics on this. And I understand, and I know the president called on SportsCenter, this Georgia bill is the Jim Crow bill on steroids. And the Players Alliance, I think, made their case really known. This was the Players Alliance tweet. We want to make our voice heard loud and clear in our opposition of the recent Georgia legislation that not only disproportionately disenfranchises the black community, but also paves the way for other states to pass similarly harmful laws based largely on widespread falsehoods and disinformation. While we will support those in need in whichever city the game is ultimately relocated to, we will also uphold our commitment to those Georgians we've already planned to serve. We'll use our voice, platform, and our partnerships now more than ever to create real, tangible change for the black community, to stand up for every American's right to vote. You got to look at this situation this way. And Rob Manfred, I think, had to make this decision. Because if you sound like the players really did not want to go to Georgia for this game, and you have players maybe that we don't know this for a fact, but players that if they wanted said, look, if this game's here, I'm not playing, and it's star players, then and maybe Manfred has pressure from sponsors as well, then you have to make this decision. I get it's hard. I understand it's also a slippery slope because now whatever city you move it to, you have to keep an eye probably on what their voting laws are. Because I look at it this way. The only thing I'll say in terms of this, I feel like if you're going to look to make a statement, you're just going to make – you can't really meet in the middle anymore because you're just going to make the people that are angry at you even more angry with you regardless. I kind of thought, and I get why, like, you can't do something in the All-Star game around promoting voting and things of that nature. And you look at what the Braves statement is. I mean, we've seen teams make statements. This is the Braves statement. The Braves are deeply disappointed by the decision of Major League Baseball to move its 2021 All-Star Game. This was neither our decision nor our recommendation, and we're saddened that fans will not be able to see this event in our city. The Braves organization will continue to stress the importance of equal voting opportunities, and we had hoped our city could use this event as a platform to enhance the discussion. Our city has always been known as a uniter in divided times, and we will miss the opportunity to address issues that are important to our community. And I appreciate listening to Monty Jones this morning. And about how the Braves, their stadium, remember, is not in Atlanta. It's in a suburb in Cobb County. You look at this situation. It's not easy. I think you could have did something around voting and kind of move the game to Milwaukee if they do kind of just honor Hank Aaron. I think that would be really cool. But now you have to be careful with your baseball because now you've made one party more mad and one party less mad and so it's a slippery slope. I'll say that. You totally understand why Rob Manfred made this decision. I don't know where they'll move the draft. I find that really interesting. But it's not easy to make it. It should be easy. Look, everybody should have an equal chance to vote, and everybody should be able to do certain things. And I think that the bill was, I mean, again, I'm not going to get into politics. But, I mean, you look at what the NBA did a couple years ago to pull the All-Star game out of Charlotte because of transgender laws. So this is trying to make an impact and get the message out that you don't like what's going on. And, I get that. Sometimes you have to make that kind of statement, but you also, not everybody in Georgia supports what the governor is doing. Like, you can have 65% of the state like what the governor is doing, 35% not. So now I've taken the All-Star game away from the other 35%. Is that right? No. But leagues have been making statements, and this is a statement Major League Baseball decided to make. And I'm really interested to see where they decide to move this All-Star game. So let me get to my predictions for the upcoming season, well, the current season. And I'll give you my – I'll try to go quickly. I'm not going to go too in-depth because, obviously, I really appreciate all the time listening to the show. So I'll go really quick. American League West, I have the A's winning the division. Houston winning the wild card. I still think, despite the A's losing these first two games, I still think the A's just always seem to find a way to make the playoffs. And I think they'll make a move at the deadline. They've got a good enough farm system. I think they can win the division. Houston, I have as the wild card there. Central, I have the White Sox. Even without Jimenez, I think they're still young offensively. Giolito, Lynn, Keuchel, who had a rough night on Friday. I think their rotation, though, will be okay. And adding Hendricks to that bullpen is huge. Twins, I have second. Cleveland, I have third in that division. Fourth, I have the Royals. I like what the Royals are doing, especially scoring 14 runs the other day. Their offense is going to be fun to watch. They might be bad, but they're entertaining, and at least they try to get better over the winter, so I can respect that. And the AL East, I have the Yankees winning the division. I have the Rays actually winning the wild card. You know, with Chris Archer and Rich Hill and Michael Wacha, they're going to do crazy things with them, and you're going to be like, why didn't my team try to sign them and do that? That's what the Rays seem to tend to do. I have the Blue Jays third, and the reason I have Toronto third, I'm not going to change it off of Thursday. Their bullpen has question marks out Kirby Yates for the season. We'll see if their closer situation is consistent all year long. We don't really have a lot in that starting rotation outside of Ryu. Robbie Ray starts the year in the IL, but he should be back quickly. But relying on Ray and Tanner Roark and Nate Pearson's out at the moment, and Steven Matz and Ross Stripling's pitching game two this afternoon against Corey Kluber. I can't go about that for 162, as good as that Blue Jays offense is. And I have the Rays beating the Astros in the wild card game. In the National League, I have the Dodgers win the division. In the West, San Diego is my wild card. In the Central, I have St. Louis. I had a tough time at the Central, but I take the team that's most consistent whenever I have a tough time, and to me, that's the Cardinals. And adding Nolan Arenado helps with Paul Goldschmidt, so Cardinals win the division slightly over Milwaukee. And in the NL East, I still got the Braves. I like the Mets. I think the problem they have with the Mets right now, with Carrasco's injury and Syndergaard's injury, they're one more pitching injury away from being in big trouble. Their bullpen has somewhat of a question mark. And I do like their offense, which, by the way, good job on them getting Francisco Lindor extended. 10 years, $341 million. Lindor had to sign because I think going a whole year without an extension in New York would have been tough for him, especially there would have been a lot of fan pressure on him. And Steve Cohen had to get this done because they traded all those players to get him. So in the end, I think both teams found a good deal. I have Washington third. It's a good third, though. I like what they're doing. I just think I question their bullpen behind Brad Hand and their health. Their starting pitching has been a question mark, especially with Strasburg in recent years. A lot of changes to that offense. They need Josh Bell to step up. They really have a hole at third base right now. Carter Kieboom starting at the alternate site. So even with Juan Soto in that outfield, there's still questions there. And I have the Padres being the Mets in the wild card. My American League Championship Series, I have the Yankees over the White Sox. My National League Championship Series, I have the Braves. So this is my upset. I have Atlanta beating San Diego. So you're probably going, Ricky, why not the Dodgers? Here's why. And this is why the weird... Remember now, when you get to the DS, there's no... You don't... Even if you're the wild card, you still play a team with the best record if that's in your division. So likely, the Dodgers are going to finish with the best record in the West. the Padres are likely going to finish in the wild card. They might even need a second best record in the National League. So that would set up a Padres-Dodgers best of five. And I look at last year, those first two games between the Padres and Dodgers were close and entertaining. Game three was the outlier because the Padres had to go to a bullpen game because they didn't really have any healthy pitching left. If the Padres stay healthy, now you've added Darvish, you've added Snell, you've added Musgrove, you have Paddock, you'll probably get Lamet back at some point. You'll have maybe Mackenzie Gore down the road. The Padres can match the Dodgers in terms of depth in pitching. You look what their bullpen's done the first couple days with Mark Melancon and Emilio Pagan. And they have Pomeranz in that pen. So at least there's options there for San Diego. I think if you're going to beat the Dodgers, it's in a best of five. So if the Dodgers are going to lose, you pick them here to lose. And I think San Diego can beat them in a playoff series just because they're going to have the chip on their shoulder, try to knock off the defending champs, and they play these teams 19 times. It's going to be so much fun to see kind of the heated rivalry between them. So I have the Braves, though, beating the Padres. I have the Yankees beating the Braves in the World Series. There are question marks with the Yankees, yes, but I think they're going to answer those in due time. I think one of Kluber and Tyone are going to work out, and keep an eye on one of those guys at the back end of that rotation between Domingo Germán, who had a good spring despite all the issues he's had and not pitched in a couple years, and Jordan Montgomery, where the velocity on his fastball has been up. And I'm looking for a big year out of Jordan Montgomery. So I like the Yankees to win their 28th World Championship. In terms of AL MVP, I went Alex Bregman. And my AL Cy Young, I went Gerrit Cole. My NL MVP, I went Fernando Tatis Jr. And my NL Cy Young, I went Jacob deGrom. I thought about being different, but Ian deGrom's just too good. So that's what I went with. So coming up next, I'm going to be joined by Daniel Epstein from the co-host of the IBWA podcast and the co-director of the IBWAA. We talk opening day takeaways, major storylines, with the upcoming season, issues that extra runner on second base and extra innings, and so much more. We get into the COVID issue as well with the Mets and Nats. It was a good interview, and we'll hopefully have Daniel on throughout the year to talk some baseball. So stay tuned for that, and then we'll have our final segment where we do NFL, and we'll look ahead to the Masters. You're listening to King with Keeler here on Full Press Radio. We'll talk more baseball after this. Day and a look ahead to the upcoming, well, the current baseball season. You can find him as the co-host of the IBWAA podcast. He's the co-director of the IBWAA. You can find his baseball writing in a lot of different places, which I'll tell you about a little bit later. Daniel Epstein is here on Kicking with Keeler. Daniel, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Ricky. How you doing? I mean, it's opening day. We've got baseball back. How can we not be doing great?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad baseball's back. I'm thrilled. It feels more normal than a year ago, which is great because I know a year ago I was like, why are we here? But now it's like, okay, we're here, and it's been really good to watch. So we've already had –
it feels more normal unless you follow the Mets or Nationals.
Yeah, we're going to get into that. We're going to get into that because I'm a little – I got some opinions on that one. But let's get into the baseball that's actually happened, and then we'll talk about the baseball that hasn't happened. I wanted to do with you three takeaways from opening day because there's so many games get played and things can sometimes kind of get overlooked. So let's do three takeaways. So what's your first takeaway to start off with?
Okay. Of course, takeaways from one game, whether it's opening day or game seven of the World Series, are always a bit of a dicey proposition. But players who just look really, really good. The first one I got to say is Ke'Bryan Hayes, who hit 376, I believe, as a rookie last year in limited plate appearances, like 95 plate appearances or something like that. But, man, did he back that up yesterday. He hit a big home run, and he just smokes the ball. He just hits line drives like crazy. And the knock on him as a prospect, he was always a big prospect, but it was always like, you know, is he going to elevate the ball enough, or is he just kind of hit singles and ground balls? And it looked last year like he was hitting fly balls and they were leaving the yard. It looked like it in spring training, and then it did leave the yard yesterday. So, I mean, he's not a 376 hitter for real, but he's good and a great defensive third baseman. So this is a guy that if Pittsburgh plays their cards right, they can build around for a very long time.
I remember
that's takeaway number one.
I remember watching Ke'Bryan Hayes. I covered the Staten Island Yankees when he was with West Virginia, I believe, and he stood out for me instantly. And that was an impressive win for the Pirates, especially holding the Cubs to two hits. I thought that was a really good win for Pittsburgh at Wrigley Field. My first takeaway, Rangers-Royals was fun and what's wrong about the sport all at the same time. You had two starters give up five runs in the first inning. You had a game end 14-10. Royals got the win. And I like the Royals offense. While their pitching is still a work in progress, their offense is fun, and at least they tried to be good. But at the same time, you had 15 different pitchers used in this game. And it just goes to show you there's not enough pitching in this sport. And while it could be entertaining to watch, and I flipped around to Rangers-Royals at a time, especially when there was a big gap in between games, so I think that kind of helped it. It does represent that, you know what, we don't really have as much elite pitching in the sport as we think we do.
No, we definitely don't. And we're at a point in baseball where everyone's like, oh, what's wrong with baseball? How come nobody bunts anymore? How come nobody hits behind the runner? And there's too many strikeouts and everything. It's just that everybody is so good, because you're right, there aren't enough good pitchers in baseball, but even the bad ones are still striking out more than one batter per inning because their stuff is so nasty. But the problem is batters don't miss. I mean, you could strike out the world, but if you hang a breaking ball or something, it's gone. It's not a single the opposite way like it used to be. It's 450 feet away. So it's just that the batters have gotten a lot better and the pitchers have gotten a lot better. And I think that that explains a lot of the trends in baseball where you've got so much of the three true outcomes, where there's so many strikeouts, so many, you know, home runs and not enough base hits and base running and things like that. Everyone's just too good right now. And I don't see that reversing itself.
So takeaway number two is what?
Takeaway number two. So I'm a Yankees fan, so my takeaway number two is how much I hate the runner on second in extra innings, which ruined the ball game. I mean, Yankees-Blue Jays was a great ball game, a great pitcher's duel, probably like the single best pitching matchup of the day, Gerrit Cole versus Hyunjin Ryu, and it lived up to the hype. 2-2 through nine innings, and, you know, top of the 10th, starts with a runner on second. Nick Nelson, relief pitcher for the Yankees, came on, gave up a double, which scored what would become the winning run on the first batter, and then got three outs right away. If you give up a double and then get, you know, three quick outs, a run shouldn't score. It shouldn't work that way. But because of a dumb rule, you know, the Yankees lost a game. And yes, I am a Yankees fan, but I'd like to think that I'm objective enough to say that, like, if it was the other way around, it'd be like, well, this was a dumb way for the Yankees to win a game. It's just, you know, I understand what they're trying to do. They can't have 18-inning games, 17-inning games where you destroy your pitching staff, but wait at least until, like, the 12th or 13th or something before you start a runner on second. There's no reason we should be doing that in the 10th inning.
Well, I cover the Yankees, write about it on Pinstripe Prospects, co-host a podcast on it, or host a podcast on it. So I completely agree with you on the extra inning front. I liked what David Cone said on the Yes broadcast on Thursday. He said, we don't have a DH yet, we have this. So yep. It's really odd, and I agree that you give the teams a couple of innings to figure it out. The game's already 4 hours anyway. Like, you're not changing the pace of play off of 10-inning games. It doesn't – I'd rather you try a couple innings out, and then when you get to the end of your pitching staff, then go to man on second, because I think that's – the minors, it was designed to stop teams from using hitters pitching in games, and you would stop using pitchers you weren't scheduled to use. So in the end, I don't like the rule at all. I think when we got back to playing full travel, I think that rule should have gone away, because I thought that's what it really was designed for. But I look at it from the Yankees standpoint, and I'm not panicking off of yesterday's game, because I think one game, like you said, one game can't define anything. I thought there were more positives for the Yankees, like Sanchez hitting and the bullpen doing a really good job with Chapman suspended and Britton out. I thought everybody did a good job there. And Toronto's bullpen answered some questions, at least for one game on Thursday. People like to boo Giancarlo Stanton, and they like to boo Gary Sanchez. And I like Aaron Judge a lot. That's a game Aaron Judge should have got booed for yesterday, because I like he's accountable. I like that he says, look, I lost the game. It's my bad. I've heard that a lot from him. And this is a big year for him. Got to stay healthy. Got to contribute. If you want that big contract, you want that Yankee lifetime deal, you've got to produce. And with bases loaded and the seventh and ninth with favorable hitters counts. This wasn't like 1-2, 0-2. He got in favorable hitters counts and did nothing with it and then misplayed the ball in the 10th. So that was not a good day for Judge. And I think for the Yankees, while their runners and scoring position problems aren't bad in regular season because they can make up for it, they hit, I think I looked up last year, home runs about 20% of the at-bats. The issue is when they get to the playoffs and you need a double and you need a single and you need that one hit, even if it's a fly ball like they need in the ninth after Talkman stole second and third, you don't trust them to do it. I texted my friend in the 10th. I said, watch him strike out in the bottom of the 10th with Judge on second, nobody out. And they almost got immaculate inning by Julian Merriweather. I mean, that was bad to watch yesterday or Thursday.
Well, yeah, I mean, Judge was the GOAT yesterday. So was LeMahieu. I mean, those are your two best hitters in the whole lineup. And they're going to be the two best hitters on the team. They lost the game for them yesterday. That's going to happen. That's baseball. You play 162 games, and the 26th man on the roster is going to win you a game sometimes. And you're going to have plenty of times where the best players on the team don't come through and lose you the game like Judge and LeMahieu did yesterday. That's just the way it is. You know, you can't overreact to these things. The two of them are going to win the Yankees a whole lot more games than they're going to lose them. It's just that yesterday didn't work out for them that way. I'll take my chances with LeMahieu and Judge in those spots more than I will anyone else on the team and just about anyone else in baseball. It's just that sometimes it doesn't come through. But you're right. There were a lot of good performances for the Yankees. In fact, my takeaway number three that I'll give you on this one, since I can go a little Yankee centric here, is Gerrit Cole's changeup. Now, I looked this up a little bit earlier today. Gerrit Cole, as they alluded to on the broadcast, like his changeup has always been his fourth pitch. You know, he threw it 5% last year. I think 7% the year before that, 4%, you know, He's never really featured the changeup. Fastball, slider, curveball. And yesterday he threw 14 changeups out of 97 pitches, which is a big increase from what he usually does. And it was out of necessity because the slider wasn't working. He did not allow a single hit off the changeup. It was, I think, 3 swings and misses, 6 foul balls, 3 balls, and an infield pop-up and an easy fly ball to right field. The changeup was good. Oh, and not only that, but he threw it exclusively when he was either behind or even in the count. So he threw it as like a get-me-over pitch, and he got strikes and swings and misses with it and a bunch of foul balls. So if he can do that with his fourth-best pitch, he already was one of the top 3 pitchers in baseball. If he added something else to his arsenal to use when his slider isn't working or his curveball isn't working, watch out. I mean, that's just not even fair for him to have that good of a changeup that he can use.
Even when Gerrit Cole isn't great Gerrit Cole, he still finds a way to be really good. Like, you look at the stat line, you go 5 1/3, 2 runs, struck out 8, gave up the home run to Hernandez, and you would think, okay, it's a good game. He was really good. The second inning to get out of that after only allowing one run was impressive when he needed almost 30 pitches. And like you said, with the changeup. So even when Cole's bad, he's good. I think that's the weird part of watching him pitch, and you enjoy that fact of it. And I agree with you. I would want LeMahieu and Judge in those spots more often than not. I just think I don't blame fans for thinking it's a microcosm of what's happened in the playoffs over the last couple of years. Like, that's the kind of game the Yankees would lose in the playoffs, where they would have chance after chance after chance after chance after chance, and nothing happened. You can obviously look at more as Gleyber Torres not really playing great defensively at shortstop and still going all right, is he the future shortstop? Again, one game, not a microcosm for most things, but that's at least on the Yankee front for me. My second takeaway, Miguel Cabrera is still good. You can hit a home run in the snow off of Shane Bieber. You still got it. Like we look at Albert Pujols and we kind of talk about how he's at the downside of his career. And you look at Pujols' contract and I'm like, you know what, for what you expect at his age, he's doing okay. I mean, Miguel Cabrera for his age last year, 10 home runs in 57 games. He's still Miguel Cabrera. He's still pretty good. And it kind of made me mad as a Shane Bieber fantasy owner that he loses the game where he strikes out 12 and how Cleveland can't hit Matt Boyd. Maybe that's a little bit more of an issue. Cleveland used to dominate the Tigers. But I think as we come to maybe appreciating what probably is our Pujols' is last year, let's give some veteran appreciation throughout the year for Miguel Cabrera.
I agree with you. I mean, you know, he's not what he used to be. He's not going to win a batting title this year. But he can still run into one and turn it around. And it's going to be a fun swan song for him. He's going to hit 25 home runs, something like that this year. And, you know, like the Tigers aren't going anywhere. I agree with you. Let's just enjoy Cabrera for the time that we have him. He's one of the all-time great hitters, especially one of the great right-handed hitters that we've ever seen. So, no, he's not what he used to be. And no, he's not going to be fun to watch in the field or on the base paths, unless, you know, you like Schadenfreude. But he's one of the all-time greats. And when he does run into one, and he will, then let's just tip our hat and clap our hands and appreciate.
Number three, I had a tough one for. I wanted to talk about all the bullpen implosions from Thursday. Look at the Giants. Kevin Gausman, another great game I got spoiled out of a win from, but I did get bailed out of a Marco Gonzalez loss from. So that actually, I guess it's haves and have-nots. Twins blowing the lead to Milwaukee. White Sox blowing the lead to the Angels thanks to Nick Madrigal's defense. But number three for me, Houston's first game with trash cans and fans and people booing the heck out of them. And they looked like, all right, we don't care. We're going to still beat the stuffing out of you. And without George Springer to still score 8 runs in this game, win 8-1. Alex Bregman was my AL MVP pick, and he's off to a really good start. Zach Greinke dominated in this game on the mound, 6 innings of 3-hit ball. The bullpen able to keep the A's to 1 run. Again, one game, not a microcosm, but for Houston to go into Oakland, they took a couple of beanings, especially from Chris Bassett. I think at Correa, somebody else at Yordan Alvarez. I mean, they're going to deal with that all year, but for one game in an opening night when it's the most electric outside, maybe when they go to New York or when they go to some of these other places, they handled it with a convincing statement in opening night.
They certainly did, and the Astros are going to be the Astros. Maybe they're not going to win 105 games like they used to because they just don't have the pitching depth that they did, but they still have a really good bullpen, and they still know how to piece together innings no matter how you slice it up, as well as anybody. And that lineup is going to do damage. Last year, they went, I think, 29-31. But, you know, their guys weren't there. Alvarez was out, I think, all year. Correa was hurt. Bregman had, I think, some injuries and didn't play well. Altuve had a down year. These guys are going to be pretty much back to normal. I think Michael Brantley hit a home run yesterday because, you know, he's on my fantasy team. But, they're going to hit. Like, they're going to score a bunch of runs. And not only that, I don't know how challenging the AL West is really going to be this year. You never know what to expect with the A's. You know, the Angels are always kind of around 500, and the Mariners and Rangers are just bad baseball teams. So I think, you know, the Astros are going to be there again in October, and they went into the ALCS before, and you know, I think there's a good chance they make some noise during the season and into the playoffs again.
So looking at the game that wasn't played, being the Mets and Nationals, which was updated on Friday that they're not going to play this weekend series. The Mets will play Monday in Philadelphia. The Nats, it's unknown because of their positive tests that they have and waiting to see if they have any more positive tests. And to me, Dan, I look at this situation and it's a reminder that COVID's still here and you want to have player safety. And I'm not one that says, well, have the Nats declare no contest and forfeit the games. I don't think that should be the case.
No.
But I also kind of look at this as I feel like there's an alternate site for a reason, and it just looks like a – I don't know if it's just because teams don't want to use the service time on the guys on the alternate site. Maybe that's the case. But you have this alternate site, and yet these games don't get played, and it derails the team that didn't get affected by COVID as well. We saw that in a few cases last year. I don't really know what to make of it. I don't – like, I understand why fans are frustrated, and I'm not – I don't understand why some fans are frustrated. It's a very weird situation, although Mike Rizzo says the Nats should play Monday. But what do you make of this?
Well, people have to remember that these are human beings, and their safety has to come first. We are still in a pandemic. Let's not make baseball – more important than it really is in the grand scheme of things. We have to take the safety of people into account, and not just the safety of the players who get the best healthcare in the world and are as low risk of a group for, you know, long-term effects or death from COVID as anybody possibly can be, even though it definitely can hit them hard, like it did for Eduardo Rodriguez or Freddie Freeman. You know, there's also a lot of people that are in the satellite of the team, the media, the clubhouse attendants, the security guards. There's, you know, the coaches, all and all the families of those people. You're going to have a lot more people who are high risk in those groups than you will with the players themselves. So safety has to be the one and only priority. The baseball we will take care of. But let's keep everybody safe and healthy as best we can. Whether or not MLB is doing that the right way, I mean, that remains to be determined. A lot of this is outside of MLB's hands. The Texas Rangers played to a full house yesterday, which ranks way up there as one of the absolute stupidest things that anyone has done in the entire pandemic. How you can put 50,000 people into one place like that is just beyond reckless. People will definitely catch COVID who went to that game yesterday. And odds are when you have that many people in one place, then there will be at least a couple of deaths that are related to people that went to a Texas Rangers game. It might not get reported, it might not get traced that way, but from what we know of this virus, that will almost definitely happen, sadly. So it's just mind-blowing to me that that could possibly be allowed. But as far as the Mets and Nationals are concerned, you know, I don't know enough about the situation to say what they should have done, what they shouldn't have done, but if there was a positive test or exposure, they absolutely did the right thing in canceling the games, even though Jacob deGrom is on my fantasy team. But you have to take safety first. And it's also a reminder to all of us that, yes, it's opening day and everyone's back in action and we're playing ball on April 1st, thank goodness, but COVID is still here. And we will still have these, you know, these suspended games because of COVID, just like we did last year. I don't know how long they will go. I don't know, you know, if we're going to have teams taking 2 weeks off like the Marlins and the Cardinals did last year or not. That all remains to be seen. But this won't be the last one that we see.
Well, at least for right now, the Rangers haven't played at home yet. They were in Kansas City yesterday. So
right, legally. Yeah. Excuse me. Sorry.
No, we're not sure yet, but I totally get where you're coming from with that. And I think – yeah, the health and safety of the players definitely has to be first, and health and safety of everybody has to be first, and nobody's saying that it shouldn't be the case. I tend to look at it as though if you have nobody at the alternate site that's tested positive, I mean, I thought about this week, looking at the minor leagues and the AAA season being delayed a month because you have the alternate site because you want to wait and see how many people get vaccinated, and that's a big issue in this country, much less in sports. But why do we have the alternate site then if we don't get people called up from it when this happens? The Marlins eventually did it. The Cardinals eventually did it. But I also understand these are three huge games. Yes, it's games 1, 2, and 3. These are divisional games. And with the way the NL East is so competitive, I don't think baseball would want to look at it I don't think it's the forefront thought, but it's the competitive balance aspect that I don't want the Mets playing a – we don't know what the tests are, but playing what would be a less than full-strength national squad.
Well, the thing is, if a player tested positive, you have to realize that there's just no way that they could have been isolated from everybody over the time that they would have not even shown symptoms yet. I mean, these players are with each other all the time. They see each other more than their families, especially in spring training. They're with each other all the time. So if one player tests positive, then everybody has been exposed. So I think that it's not just a situation where you can isolate one person or you can isolate a couple of people that might have been exposed and then call up two or three guys from the minors or something. I just don't see a way in which if one Nationals player is exposed, then they all are not exposed. There's just no possible way for that to happen. So if that is indeed the case, then they did the right thing by canceling the games. You also don't want to see the Nationals replacement squad playing either. I mean, that's not fair to the Nationals. That's not fair to the Mets. That's not fair to the whole National League if the Mets are playing games against the Harrisburg Senators wearing Nationals jerseys. So, again, you have to just think about what we know about this virus. And, if there is a situation where they can just isolate one person and say, this is a person who has been in touch with the virus, but no one else has, then okay. But I just don't see a way in which that could possibly happen with as close contact as all of the people in the team satellite universe are with each other.
Definitely a good point. And to update it again, 4 players tested positive. Right now, 9 are out because of contact tracing. And from reading under, I know Talk Nats has this, and they're really good. Under DC rules, they would not be able to play. Mm-hmm. So to have that many people out, that is a concern. And we'll see how the Nationals handle it if and when their season begins Monday against Atlanta, I believe. Let's run through this pretty quick, Dan. Looking at it, we talked about some storylines like COVID and the extra inning rule. What are some other storylines? Give me one or two you're focused on this season.
Storylines I'm focused on. Well, this is one that people aren't necessarily going to be worried about too much right now in April, but it's going to grow as the season progresses. And that is labor negotiations between the MLB Players Association and MLB, because as you know, the collective bargaining agreement or the basic agreement expires when the World Series ends. So these two sides, which have no love for each other right now, are going to have to negotiate a new agreement with each other before anybody could take the field in 2022. And that's not going to be easily done, because the owners, and I'm sorry, I can't both sides this. I just can't. The owners are, unbelievably greedy and incomprehensibly wealthy, and have been benefiting from, ridiculous amounts of growth in revenue and income for decades now. And they're going to try and penny pinch the players. And they usually get away with it because the players just sort of acquiesce and end up with progressively worse collective bargaining agreements for the players and for the sport's health as a whole. And if the players want to reverse that trend, they're going to have to dig their heels in, which might mean a very, very difficult, very contentious labor negotiations. And I don't know exactly what we're going to see, what's going to happen this offseason with that. But this whole season is preamble for a huge, huge battle that is to come that will define when, if, and how baseball is played in 2022 and beyond.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, it's an issue I'd love to get into at a later time, especially, but I think when you have the two sides that can't agree on a DH when it worked last year, when you can't agree on expanded playoffs in some form, while I would have liked to see the one seeds get a bye, I thought the expanded playoffs at least brought popularity to the sport. It made people watch 8 games a day, and people enjoyed it. That when fans enjoy it, you take that away and you go back to a system that I think, to me, the storyline, Dan, when I'm looking at, I'm going to ask you about your picks in a second. I was doing my picks and I had a tough time coming up with anything different than a year ago, because I like teams like Toronto making moves, but that was to be expected, and the White Sox making moves was to be expected. The other sports usually have, except maybe in the NBA, you have teams that come out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know over 162. Like last year was great because you had the Marlins coming out of nowhere, the Giants, teams that had the COVID situation just rally in 60 games and make the playoffs. You don't have that, I think, in a 162, because eventually the elite's going to separate themselves. And I think when we get to the summer, I don't know how many competitive playoff races we're actually going to have.
You know, I think we will have some out-of-nowhere teams. Before I even get to that, though, but, you know, like, I think that the DH and the expanded playoffs and that whole discussion, that's just a very good example of why you really can't both sides, the whole owner versus players thing, because, you know, both the owners and the players want the universal DH. It's good for both sides. It's good for everybody. But the owners were like, well, in order to get the universal DH, which is really just 16 additional starting jobs, or 15 additional starting jobs, a little bit more playing time for the players, so it's not a huge positive for them. The owners wanted them to accept an expanded playoffs deal that would be massively, massively beneficial towards the owners and really bad for the players. Because the way that the expanded playoffs were set up last year, and yeah, like, you know, more baseball, more October baseball, more pennant races, yes, that's good and everything like that. But if there is no advantage between the 1 seed and the 8 seed, where they just have to play a 3-game series against each other no matter what, then there's really no advantage to building a team that's designed to win more than 85 games in a season. There's no reason for the Dodgers to keep spending money, or the Yankees to keep spending money, because you got to do a 3-game play-in series, whether you win 85 games and squeak in, or, you know, 105 games like the Dodgers. So when you look into team building, that's going to dramatically decrease team spending and dramatically decrease player payrolls. And that's exactly the kind of thing that the players end up getting screwed on by accepting those deals. So they did the right thing in turning that down. But that's exactly the problem here, is that the owners said, you have to give us something really good for us and really bad for you in order for us to accept the universal DH, which is something that is mutually agreeable. And that's just bad faith negotiating. That's something that, if you're the players, how do you negotiate with someone who's taking that kind of tack? So that's why I really feel like it's hard to both sides this issue, because the owners and Manfred are really, you know, acting reprehensibly with the way that they try and negotiate these things. And we should have a universal DH right now. That should be exactly the kind of thing where they say, listen, we both agree on this. It's good for everybody. Let's just do it, instead of trying to use it as a bargaining chip for something else. But, you know, I digress. Sorry. But, you know, out of nowhere teams, I don't know who they're going to be this year, but I think that you will have them. I mean, we usually do have them. You know, that's just the beauty of baseball. Yes, the elites are going to be there. I mean, no one's going to expect the Dodgers to, you know, suddenly go 75-87 or something like that. They're going to be great. And I'm sorry, much as I like Brian Hayes, Pittsburgh is going to be terrible. There's just no way around it, you know. But there's going to be teams that really surprise. I wouldn't be surprised to see the Brewers actually make some noise. I kind of really like the Brewers. The Brewers might have the best team defense in all of baseball, and they might have the best bullpen in all of baseball. And then you stack that up with, you know, a pretty solid starting rotation. Well, I won't say solid, but, like, they've definitely got a great 1-2 in Corbin Burnes and Brandon Woodruff. That might be enough to make some noise in MLB's weakest division, the NL Central. So the Brewers, I don't know if you can call them an out-of-nowhere team, but everyone in the NL Central was kind of around 500 a year ago, and I think the Brewers could end up being really good.
Yeah, I was about to say, can you have a surprise team in the Central when the Central is, in lack of a better word, a crapshoot? I like Milwaukee too. I think St. Louis. When I look at the Central, when I'm not sure on a prediction I take the team with most consistency, and to me that's probably St. Louis. And they added Nolan Arenado, so I think that kind of helped me picking the Cardinals there. I'm thinking like there are intriguing young teams. Like I'm really intrigued with when Kelenic comes up with and Julio Rodriguez, maybe what Seattle looks like. I'm intrigued to see what Detroit is with AJ Hinch. We talked about the Royals and their young team, what they look like. I would even say it's weird to call them out of nowhere or a surprise, but Boston with Cora, you wonder if that's going to have some kind of impact. But to me, I think you look at it and there's just I feel like there's the group of elite teams and then there's the middle to . And while it's great for the Yankees and Dodgers being great is great for the sport. I'm not I want to see these bet. Like that's what was great about what the Royals did. And it's weird. I'm talking about the Royals so much in this segment, but it's that they know they're probably not going to be very good, but they're trying. And I think that's what makes you like, okay, I'll watch them because you know what? They're giving an effort. Seattle, at least suppose what their former CEO did. Mm-hmm. They're giving an effort. Like they're at least, I don't know many of the guys in their bullpen, but they're interesting, and that by the middle of the year, they'll be interesting, and I'll want to watch them.
You know, can I give you a reverse out of nowhere team, a team that I think is actually not going to be very good?
Sure.
That's going to be Toronto for me, even though they beat the Yankees mm-hmm. yesterday. It's going to sound like I'm, you know, vindictive or something, but the Blue Jays that you saw yesterday, that's a good team. But Ross Stripling, I believe, is starting their second game of the season. Right. Ross Stripling as their number two starter, that's a guy who the Angels, who are an extremely pitching-starved team, didn't even want basically for free a year ago. And then Stripling actually got worse. So that's their number two starter. Toronto, for as much as everyone loves them, and they're kind of a trendy pick to make the playoffs, and some people even think they can challenge in the division, they don't have any pitching. I mean, beyond Ryu, who is an ace, no questions asked. But he's only going to be able to pitch every fifth day. What do you do in the 130 games that Ryu doesn't start? A team's going to score a bunch of runs, but especially when they get Springer back healthy, but they're not going to have the pitching to hang in there as a playoff team, in my opinion.
I agree with you on Toronto's pitching. I would be surprised just how good the top three are in the American League East. And by top three, I think people are sleeping on Tampa. I really do. I know Kevin Cash didn't look like a genius in the World Series, but he's still a genius. And they're going to take Chris Archer and Rich Hill and Colin McHugh and Michael Walker and do things that make people go, why didn't I think of that? And you saw even in Thursday's game against the Marlins, the game they won 1-0, but how great Tyler Glasnow could be. Outdueling Sandy Alcantara, how good that Austin Meadows could be when he's healthy, hits the home run that decides the game. And get a full year of Rosarena. We'll see if he's the same guy. But until Tampa Bay is like out of the playoffs, you can't really count them out. And they just are a thorn in the Yankee side, a thorn in everybody else's side in the division. Tampa's going to be competitive. I would not be shocked if they're back in the playoffs again.
Oh, I fully expect Tampa to be back in the playoffs, regardless of who wins the AL East. The Rays, for all the reasons that you just said, they're still a great team. And, you know, they're not going to take Blake Snell out in the sixth inning this year, that's for sure. But they've got all the horses that you just mentioned, and they're always loaded, and they're always going to reload. And not only that, they're always going to have some guy that was a 34th round pick who's like 29 and has had two Tommy John surgeries that they call up and turns into – you know, a 150 ERA reliever who can throw three innings at a time from innings like 5 through 7 or something like that. They just always have guys like that. So yeah, the Rays are going to be there. They're going to be a huge challenge, and it's going to be a lot of fun battles between them and the Yankees all year.
Yeah, I always look at it like, wait, there's a guy with a 4 ERA in on Tampa, yet he's throwing 3 scoreless innings as the opener. I don't know how this is, but it's I always said it. I said it with the playoffs last year. Kevin Cash plays chess, and everybody else plays checkers. And that's really what it comes down to. Why everybody else is trying to play chess. But let's end on this note, Dan. What's your World Series pick for this season?
I mean, I usually end up going chalk on these things because, I mean, I feel like you've just got to kind of pick the best teams because you never have an idea what's going to happen over a regular season, and you especially never have an idea what's going to happen in a bunch of short playoff series. So I will say Dodgers over Yankees in the World Series.
All right, so I think it's the chalk pick. I think it's the right pick in most cases. So let's do this for the National League then. Give me the team that's best, because I think the AL, I think we can agree that it's the White Sox, probably the most equipped. The Astros, probably the two teams most equipped to challenge the Yankees for the AL pennant. But look at the NL pennant. Biggest challenge to the Dodgers is who?
Oh, easily the Padres. The Padres are not only the second best team in the NL West, they're the second best team in Major League Baseball. I think that there is a scenario in which both the Dodgers and the Padres win over 100 games this year. They are absolutely loaded, and they're going to be loaded for a very long time, and we're just going to have two juggernauts battling it out for the next several years. The Dodgers have the upper hand. They've got a little bit more pitching depth, but man, both of those teams are just absolutely going to demolish everyone else they play except each other. So that's going to be one of the huge fun things to watch all year long with the Dodgers and Padres.
Here's why I didn't pick any of them. I think that the Padres will win the wild card and they'll play the Dodgers in the DS and they're going to beat each other up. And I think that's going to play a factor in one of those. I actually picked in the NL pennant. I'm going Atlanta. I think people forget Soroka's coming back at some point. And adding Morton and Smiley to that young rotation with Ian Anderson, they're still going to be good. Their offense brought back Ozuna, contract year for Freddie Freeman. And I also looked at it as Alex Anthopoulos, the more he knows this system, the more likely he's going to make a big splash at some point and make a trade. So I think that's coming at some point. The Braves have a really good farm system. I think Atlanta, people are sleeping on because of what the Mets did and what Washington's rotation. Atlanta was a game away and probably a defensive mistake away from – or bait was not a defense, but base-running mistake away from going to the World Series last year. And I think that's going to drive them this season. So I'm taking Atlanta.
Not a bad pick. The Braves are a very, very good team as well. They always seem to end up caught with good pitching, and you can't doubt a lineup that has – Ronald Acuna and Freddie Freeman and Ozzy Albies and Marcelo Ozuna. They're a good team top to bottom.
Also, the scary part, contract year for Freddie Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to scare every pitcher in the National League that it's a contract year for Freddie Freeman. And it doesn't sound like he's getting an extension anytime soon. But, Dan, before I let you go, tell listeners out there about all the work you're doing with the IBWAA, with the podcast, where they can find your work, how they can follow everything on Twitter.
Yeah, well, so the Internet Baseball Writers Association of America, you know, me and a friend of mine, we took it over about 10 months ago, towards the end of May. And it's just been such a great experience helping to connect not only different writers, but all kinds of different content creators throughout the baseball world. And we've had a lot of positive feedback. We started a bunch of different brand new initiatives, such as the IBWAA podcast, where we, you know, have interviews and highlight different IBWAA members every week. You know, we have regular Zoom meetings for members. We started a newsletter called Here's the Pitch, which you can subscribe to for free or for fee. And the money goes to paying the writers, you know, plus a whole bunch of other things, partnerships with great organizations like Sabre. The response has been outstanding from the baseball community, and our membership has grown considerably. You know, I think we're up to 707 members now, where, we were at 581 when we took over 10 months ago. So we've, had, outstanding growth. And not only that, but, you know, January, February, and March of this year have been three of our best months for new members as well. So, there seems to be a lot of buzz around the IBWAA, and I'm really proud of that, and I'm really excited to see, you know, all the great content that our members put out there all the time, and I'm really happy to be a part of that. And as for me personally, you know, I can be found on Twitter at D Epstein 1983. And where do I write? I write for Baseball Prospectus. I write for Last Word on Sports, and I write for Off the Bench Baseball.
So be sure to check all Dan's work. I'm in the IBWAA. It's a great organization to be a part of, and you get so many different baseball minds talking about the sport that everybody loves. And I think it's a really fun initiative where you get the Hall of Fame voting and awards and everything like that. You get it to be a part of a group that I think is fantastic. And I enjoy at least – I joined, I think, about 2-3 years ago, and I've enjoyed being a part of it. And Dan with running it, co-running it with the podcast, it's always a lot of fun, and hope to do this again in the future. Dan, thanks again for coming on. Hope we'll talk again at some point during the year. Thanks for taking some time today.
You got it, Ricky. Thanks for having me.
Special thanks to Daniel Epstein for hopping on the show, talking some baseball. We'll hopefully get him on throughout the season. Always look to talk baseball. Love talking baseball here on the show. I'm glad it's back. If you're looking for maybe a series to watch over the course of this week, I think there's a couple of pretty good ones. Right now, as I get to Monday, looking at some of the interesting series, Dodgers-A's, this is a really tough stretch for the A's playing the Astros and the Dodgers right out of the gate, but that's always a good series. Astros and Angels, good litmus test for Los Angeles. Braves and Nats, we've talked about how big that series could potentially be. And then going into next weekend, you got Nats at Dodgers, A's and Astros again. And looking at the Thursday slate, because remember that's home openers. Angels Blue Jays, I think, is a good one in Toronto. So yeah, you got a couple of good matchups here. I think it should be entertaining, at least in the Brewers Cardinals. Good matchup in the NL Central. So looking at the NFL, really the only big news this week. I know we had the other news in the NFL where the police are looking to report concern to Deshaun Watson. We talked about that in the last couple of weeks. Just a crazy situation. So we'll talk about that as more information becomes aware of that. But the news in the NFL was the owners approving the 17-game regular season. Your 17th game is basically if you play the team in the other conference that finished in the same place you did in your division. So me liking the Patriots, they're going to play the Dallas Cowboys at home. AFC teams get 9 home games. NFC gets 8. Next year it'll flip. Look, 17 games was a reality. It was going to happen, especially with the new CBA. They cut the preseason to 3, which I think is smart, although I would always have done 2. One where you play your starters a lot, one where you don't play your starters a lot, and you kind of see what the other players have. I think you only need 2 preseason games, 1 home game each for each team. There are questions of staying healthy. I mean, how do you keep your players healthy over the course of a 17-game regular season? Does that mean we go off of what happened a year ago and we maybe have more virtual off-season work to kind of lessen the hits people take in practice? Or maybe you carry some of those things over. That's a possibility. And it means more money, and especially for the salary cap. That's going to help the cap, which was down in recent years, and you add that extra revenue into the NFL. You also have the case where every team has to play internationally, I think, over like the next few years. Oh, once every 8 years. That's the course of the schedule. So in the end, I think I understand why the NFL did it. I get why players are upset about it. But it's also the nature of the business you're in. In the end, people say it in the NFL all the time, it's a business. So it remains to be seen. Now, there's still reports, again, that the Patriots looking at quarterbacks. You saw what Robert Kraft said this week. And people – Robert Kraft basically said, we didn't put a lot around Cam Newton and the Patriots have to do better, especially in the draft. And people looked at it as Robert Kraft calling out Bill Belichick and saying, well, how dare you? Bill Belichick's won 6 Super Bowls. He's always in Super Bowl contention every year up until this year. Yes, but I think there's room for Kraft to call out his coach. Bill Belichick, the GM, did not have good drafts the last couple years. And it set the Patriots back. I mean, think about it. After trading up for both tight ends they got last year, they had to go sign 2 tight ends because those other ones didn't pan out, at least after year 1. They drafted N'Keal Harry, who's done nothing on offense. So the reason they had to spend so much in free agency, and the reason Kraft had to open up the checkbook, is because Bill Belichick, as a GM, has drafted poorly. And that's why this draft is so big for the Patriots, because they have to get it right if they do end up in a position to get a quarterback. And if they don't, then like Robert Kraft said, you've got to put the weapons around Cam Newton and try to see what he has. And hopefully a year away from COVID, he'll be better. But people say, oh, how dare Kraft call him out? No, Kraft should call him out. I'm not saying put Belichick on the hot seat, but Bill deserves his fair share of criticism. He did a great job considering he was 7-9 with that roster, but he ultimately put that roster together. In the end, Bill the GM hurt Bill the coach. Just the way it is. In terms of the NBA, really shocking what happened between the Warriors and the Raptors on Friday night. That was a weird basketball game. The Warriors, like, lost by over 50 points. One of those games, like, if you're Golden State, you want to just throw in the time capsule and get rid of it. It was 130-77, 36 points for Pascal Siakam. You look at that Golden State lineup, again, no Curry, no Draymond Green. So it's Wiggins, Toscano Anderson, Wiseman, Kelly Oubre Jr., and Jordan Poole. And you understand where Draymond coming from, where he says, look, I don't really want to play in play-in games. There's no excitement for that. And I get where Draymond's coming from, too, because Golden State's been the championship all the time. Now, making the playoffs is making the playoffs, but if you're Golden State, you've been in these playing games before, you're not healthy. Klay Thompson's not coming back. Curry dealing with something. Draymond's been dealing with injuries throughout the season. Not an easy thing by any stretch of the imagination. So just kind of the Warriors getting put back into reality in a sense is interesting. Now, the other big news in the NBA this week was the whole people getting mad about buyouts. The Nets were able to get LaMarcus Aldridge. Lakers got Andre Drummond, who had an injury there, not against the Bucks, but he's going to be okay. And I'll say this about the NBA. The NBA, you have 6 or 7 teams that are going to win the championship, and those players are going to want to go there. But if you're a fan that's mad that the Nets got LaMarcus Aldridge, like, that's not the player I'd put my outrage at. I mean, he got bought out, and he can pick where he wants to go. And the Nets already put the super team together with James Harden. Were you this outraged on Harden as you were with Blake Griffin and LaMarcus Aldridge, who are not the players they once were? Now, will they help? Yes. Are they going to be difference makers? Probably not. They might help the Nets win a game or two. I don't think they're going to be difference makers in winning a championship. And the Lakers, even with Drummond. I mean, in the end, the Lakers are going to win because if they have a healthy LeBron James and a healthy Anthony Davis. But sadly, that's where the NBA is right now. They're the haves and the have-nots. And players don't want to go play for the have-nots. Now, Adam Silver did put rules in place to where teams could offer a lot more to get players to stay. And I think it's helped to a degree. It got Giannis to stay in Milwaukee. But there's only certain teams that NBA players want to play for. And they're going to build super teams. Just the way the NBA works right now. I think the only outrage of the Nets is the way James Harden got himself to Brooklyn. They signed Kevin Durant in free agency. They signed Kyrie Irving in free agency. They built the super team that way. And the Nets have played outstanding basketball even without Kevin Durant. It was too busy having Twitter DM arguments with Michael Rapoport and using really bad language. And one thing I'll say about Kevin Durant, and again, you can understand why Durant would be angry at Rapoport, but you're Kevin Durant, you got to realize, hey, I can't let that get to me. And if Rapoport's putting it out there on social media, again, you could argue, we've heard Stephen A. Smith and others say, like, there's a code you just don't cross. But you also have to realize that you're Kevin Durant. You can't let that get to you. This guy's known for burner accounts. This guy who's known for getting under his skin really easily. So he's got to know better, especially when you've been out for 2+ months with that hamstring. Got to focus on getting back on the court if you're Kevin Durant. He got fined $50,000. I think the NBA had to do something. There was a lot of really disturbing language in there. They had, especially, yes, it's a DM, but it's still a conversation. Once it's public, you can't have it go away. So the NBA had to fine him. I think they did the right thing there. Looking at an updated standings, we usually do every week. The Heat have won three in a row. They get into that sixth seed in the East. Knicks have lost three straight, including a loss to Minnesota. Say being that play-in series right now with Boston, Indiana, who's lost three in a row, and the Bulls, despite trading for Nikola Vucevic, have lost six straight. Toronto's actually pulled within a game of that 10 spot. Washington's two back, and Orlando's 2.5. Cleveland's 2.5. Excuse me. In the West, you have the Jazz winning 8 in a row. So the Utah's back to where their dominance was at the beginning of the season. They built up a 3-game lead on Phoenix, who's won 5 straight. Denver's won 4 in a row since acquiring Aaron Gordon. They're in the 5th spot in the West, half game behind the Lakers, and a game behind the Clippers they just beat in L.A. the other day. Dallas has won 3 straight, but they're in the 7th spot. San Antonio, Memphis, and Golden State right now at the 10. They're a game ahead of Sacramento and a game and a half ahead of the Pelicans, who traded J.J. Redick. Josh Hart's also hurt for them. Can Zion lift the Pelicans to the playoffs? That's going to be something to watch over the final month of the regular season. About 20-plus games for each team remaining. So getting to the nitty-gritty of the NBA season. Again, I always give you games to watch during the week, so let me do that for you real quick. We'll pull up some games. Let's go Knicks-Nets on Monday. That's always entertaining, especially in the East. You have on Tuesday, Sixers at Celtics on TNT, and Trailblazers at Clippers. That's not a TNT game. Bucks-Warriors is, but I think Trailblazers-Clippers is more entertaining. Wednesday, Knicks-Celtics is a huge game for play-in purposes. Spurs-Nuggets, Jazz at Suns. Good matchup on Wednesday with the two best records in the West. That game is in Phoenix, 10 o'clock on ESPN. Thursday night, Suns at Clippers on TNT, Portland at Utah. Friday night, we have Spurs at Nuggets again, Sixers at Pelicans, Knicks home to Grizzlies. Tough week for the Knicks, by the way. Nets, Celtics, and Grizzlies. Grizzlies are a 500 team, so should be interesting. And then Saturday night, Lakers at Nets. Obviously, that game is different without LeBron and without AD, but that's still a nationally televised game. I'm sure I wonder what ABC is thinking about that right now. But that's your look at the games for this week. Now, I wanted to wrap up this week by taking a look at the Masters. As I mentioned at the top of the show, next week's shows, again, we air these shows on Saturdays, so the third round of the Masters will be going on. Of course, I'll give you my take on the first two rounds next week, but I figured I'd talk about the Masters this week. I'm really interested in how this course looks. Again, we go back to it being in April. We go back to it being where I think the conditions are going to be a lot more tougher to get low scores as opposed to when it was in November last year when the greens aren't as firm. You can make birdies. It'll be a little bit tougher this week. Dustin Johnson goes in as the defending champion. I'm going to give you a couple golfers I like this week. One being Jordan Spieth. We've seen Jordan Spieth play a lot better this season. Seems to be back to the guy, maybe not the guy who won majors over the last recent years, but the player that's been in contention more often than not. You find at the top of the leaderboard nearly every week, and I try to watch most of the golf when it's on. I saw Billy Horschel win the match play. I thought that was interesting. But Jordan Spieth, as of today, two shots back in the Texas Open, so he at least is in contention, gets four more competitive rounds under his belt. The guy who's won the Masters before. And when you look at Masters champions, you always want to look at the best in the world and players who have won before. Because Augusta doesn't really put itself against... It's not like the other majors where players with not a lot of major experience have a chance to win. Like the U.S. Open, the British Open, or the Open Championship, whatever you call it, the PGA. Where the Masters, you kind of have to know the course to win it. And you have your occasional, like, Trevor Immelman's winning and Mike Weir's. But usually the top players in the world that find a way to win. Bryson DeChambeau's an interesting case. I just feel like he overthinks himself, and that kind of costs you at Augusta. When you overthink, you're going to make a mistake, especially on 12. So I like Spieth. I got a good feeling on Victor Hovland. I think he's got a good shot, and I'll give you one more. Remember, no Tiger. Obviously, he's still recovering from the car accident. No Koepka, which I think is a big loss. I thought about John Rahm. I don't got a good feeling on John Rahm, but I could be wrong. Rory McIlroy is always a good favorite, but I'm not going to pick Rory because he's just been inconsistent. When things go wrong for Rory, they go really, really wrong for Rory. So I'm trying to think of who would be another. Probably Justin Thomas, coming off the win at the Players. And Justin Thomas, remember, has not won a Masters. He's only won a PGA. So I'll give you Spieth, I'll give you Hovland, I'll give you Justin Thomas. Those are the three guys I kind of like this week. The Masters is one of those tournaments that I'm usually tuning in, as long as I'm not working, where I'm watching from first ball to last. So Thursday, I'm definitely watching a lot of Masters and a little bit into Friday as well. Should be a fun event. At least there's limited fans. Brings back some of the aura from the Masters, where last year was like a very quiet Augusta, and it was interesting to watch. It's going to be a little bit closer to what it normally is. But I'm really excited for it, and I'm always looking forward to Jim Nantz and CBS crew, who do a really good job calling the action. So I want to thank Sam Connan from Daily Bruin. I want to thank Daniel Epstein from the IBWA for hopping on the show this week, doing a little UCLA basketball and a little baseball. We'll be back next week to recap the national championship. The baseball season's still underway. We'll talk about the first two rounds of the Masters. Basketball winding down, hockey winding down, latest NFL draft stuff. We got so much going on in the world of sports. Hard to fit it all in, but we thank all of you for tuning in this week. I want to remind you, you can follow me on Twitter at RickAnator555. Follow us on Twitter at FP_coverage at Full Press Radio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, wherever you get your podcasts. Just search Kicking with Keeler. Chances are it is there. Please give a rating. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you don't like. You can email me, rickjkeeler@gmail.com. Again, thank you to all those who tuned in. Last week's episode was one of the better episodes we've done in recent years in terms of downloads, so I really thank you all for tuning in. I don't know what I did differently, but thank you all for tuning in. It means a lot when you all take the time to listen in. I really do appreciate it. Be sure to download the Full Press Coverage app on your iOS or Android device. All articles, podcasts, live shows are there. And again, if you want to be part of our team, go to fullpresscoverage.com and sign up today. We really look forward to hearing from you. You can catch my work over at pinshyprospects.com as the managing editor over there. We do the Chasing 28 podcast every week. We did our opening day predictions, Yankees and baseball, on last week's show. We'll do a lot more minor league content over the next month. Remember, minor league season begins in May. And by the way, keep an eye on Kumar Rocker and Jack Leiter at Vanderbilt. Jack Leiter, again, 12 strikeouts last night against LSU. I'm looking forward to watching Vanderbilt baseball because those two are so much fun to watch. And they're going to be two top five picks in the draft. So we'll have more draft coverage throughout the summer. But that will be something to keep an eye on over at pinstripeprospects.com. You can catch my work over at Baird Sports Media as well. A couple articles did this week. I did Bomani Jones and Dominique Foxworth talking about how draft analysts need to be specific with the way they cover criticism of black quarterbacks. So that was something I found interesting. And Colin Coward, before opening day, talking with Bob Costas about how baseball has failed as an entertainment product, which I tend to agree with, because I think they've kind of, when you have analytics, like Bob Costas said, it tends to ruin entertainment. So great discussion between Colin, and whenever Bob Costas talks baseball, you got to listen. So from all of us here at Full Press Radio and Full Press Coverage, I'm Ricky Keeler saying have a great holiday weekend, whatever you're celebrating. I hope you enjoy it. Stay safe, follow the rules, wear a mask, and I'll see you back here next week. Thanks for kicking it with me, Ricky Keeler, this weekend, and I'll see you next time.